Councilmember Fonzi?
Here.
Councilmember Moreno?
Here.
Councilmember Kelly?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Sturtevant?
Here.
Mayor O'Malley?
Here.
All present.
Thanks. First item on the agenda is the approval of the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
I have a motion by Councilman Fonzi, seconded by Mayor Pro Tem Sturtevant. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Fonzi?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Councilmember Moreno?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Sturtevant?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
I move approval of the other consent calendar items.
Second.
Very good. We have a motion by Councilman Fonzi, seconded by Mayor Pro Tem Sturtevant, for all consent calendar items excluding number 5. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Fonzi?
Yes.
Councilmember Moreno?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Sturtevant?
Yes, and I need to abstain on 2 as I was not part of that tour on that day. Thank you.
And Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes, except for item number 2.
Thank you. Item number 5.
I meant item number 2, where Mayor Pro Tem Sturtevant is abstaining. I'm sorry.
Certainly. This is the second reading for our proposed amendment to the camping ordinance. The city of Atascadero currently has on the books a camping ordinance that prohibits camping in certain areas in certain parts of town. We found over the course of the last couple of years that the ordinance had become unenforceable. Our local judge had determined that there were not clear enough definitions in the ordinance to make the ordinance enforceable unless our officers stayed with someone and watched them throughout the entire night camping. And so we worked with the city attorney to prepare an ordinance that had definitions as appropriate to the section, and worked with others or looked at other cities and what they had done in their ordinances to make sure that ours would fit both the legal definitions that were required and would be prosecutable and appropriate. One of the things that our ordinance has is a requirement that law enforcement provide some sort of option or opportunity for people to seek shelter. And we have now made that available through the city with our Echo shelter being designated. And so we were waiting on the designation of Echo as an appropriate housing facility or housing location before we proceeded with this camping ordinance. Now that that's done, we did proceed and came to council with a request to amend the ordinance make it enforceable for persons camping or storing their personal belongings in the public or private way. And now we are here coming back to you for a second reading on that ordinance to pass it.
Thank you. And we'll
open up public comment. Yeah. Okay, Mayor Tom and council members, my name is Jerry Clay. 7285 Sycamore Road. I'm really not here to trash the ordinance. I'm here as a concerned citizen. I talked to a couple outside of the 99-cent store. They had a little dog, and I went in and I got them some dog food and one thing and another, and talked to them a little bit, and they were pretty. I mean, they were just as coherent as you and I, and. I said, hey, you guys have got to get to a warming center. That was the night before it rained, and they said, well, we can't because we have a dog. And, Now, I know there's people there that say, well, that's really silly to have a dog. But for a homeless person, a dog is someone to give them an alert if someone's coming. In some respects, it's a protection of them and so on. So, a dog gives them unconditional love, and they really need that. And so, anyway, these folks had to stay out. They didn't ask me for any money or anything. I did ask the girl. She said she was 30 years old, and she went to school in Atascadero, finished up at continuation school. The guy was, they were both pretty clean cut. You probably know who they are, Gerald, but he said he is a painter, and he's just out of work, and they don't, have any place to stay or very little money. They did tell me that their camp was red tagged, and they were told to find another city or find another area in town and so on, which I can certainly understand. But I guess my concern is these are human beings. Some of them are from Atascadero. Some of them, I think there's this feeling out there that they're all from another area. Well, that's not true. I know I had two or three of my kids that were on my youth teams that ended up as homeless people. And one of them actually passed away. But I look at, if you ever watch the stock shows, Kramer has this big show, and he's a multimillionaire, and he was homeless, living in his car. He was an alcoholic at one time in his younger days, and he's, a fabulous person now. On the on the X Factor, there was a boy there that was homeless in L.A., and he did such an outstanding job of singing and went right on up through it. But I guess my point is, what I wanted to plant some seeds, we need a daycare center for people. And I was in the Sunken Gardens, and this was a few months ago, and there was two little girls and a man and a woman, and they had a little baby in a stroller. And I said, gee, it was cold. It was that morning. And I said, what are you doing here? And he said, well, we just left Echo. They put you out at 7:30 in the morning. Now, they had to go all day long, and before the meal was served and so on, just hanging out. And that's, what's happening now. We need a daycare center. I know there's someone out there, a sugar daddy, a person with money that could help Echo. They could build it where Echo is now. Maybe the old library could be when they move, that would be a spot. But we need a place where kids can do homework. They could have some babysitting, so to speak, drug counseling, job interviews type of thing, and really do things right. Echo is doing an outstanding job, but we need the second phase. We need a daycare center badly, and we also need a place where a kennel, and I know this is going to blow people's minds, but when you get older like myself, dogs are very important. I'm sure Roberta can relate to that. And, just to give up your dog so you can get warm, turn it loose or something like that is not a good thing.
Thank you.
But you're certainly welcome, and I hope people out there are listening. It's cold, and those two folks were out there and got rained on and got frozen. I was sleeping in my little bed, and when I tucked in, I had to think about them.
Well, Councilman Clay, you would appreciate when I started off on KPRL this afternoon, I said, boy, I sure hope that global warming kicks in pretty soon because we're freezing up here in the North County. So, thank you. Well, again, we had a considerable discussion on this item at our last council meeting and considered many of these issues. We know there's more to do. We are very proud of our ECHO program. I would ask our police chief to follow up on first, let me see. I don't see anyone else approaching for public comment, so I will close public comment, ask our chief to just follow up with anything you would add to what you've heard.
There were a couple of things that Jerry brought up that we have discussed and have talked about. One of the things that was a concern to us in law enforcement as well is what do we do with animals? Many of the people that we come in contact with say that they will not use the shelter because ECHO does not allow animals. It's one thing that we have discussed with Bill Watt, the director of ECHO. Right now there is no good answer, but it is something that we have asked him to take a look at and something that he said he would consider. Currently they do provide services for service animals, there at the shelter, but it is a difficulty. There is damage to the facility and other things that they have to account for. So it's a work in progress, something that still needs to be done. I think one of the second concerns that Jerry talked about was the issue of, you know, people who find themselves suddenly homeless, and certainly we have seen many success stories from individuals who at one point in time or another found themselves in that state and were able to kind of carry themselves out of it or received help to get themselves out of that state. And again, the reason we waited with this ordinance until ECHO was on board and kind of solidified as our homeless shelter in town was because we want the same thing. For most of these individuals, they need a helping hand. They don't need law enforcement. And so we did take care to put provisions in the ordinance that would not allow us to take enforcement action unless we had provided them with the alternative service, at least given them the opportunity to use that service. One of the things that our department is working on, Corporal Schamber is currently working on it, is a sheet of information that we'll give to individuals when we contact them the first time for camping or another violation under this ordinance. It'll have a list of the names of our current local shelters and those in the communities around us so that we give them plenty of opportunity to look for places where they can go and receive services and aid rather than simply coming under the heavy hand of law enforcement without any opportunity to provide from themselves in any other way. And so we do take some of those things into account and are working to try and ensure that we are compassionate, and yet at the same time, as Mrs. DeCou said when we were discussing this ordinance, at a certain point in time, we will have to take enforcement action. You can only do just so much to assist people and help them, and if, at some point in time with some of our individuals, we believe that we probably will be taking enforcement action against them when it becomes necessary.
Thank you. And I believe you also have a policy and procedure for dealing with personal property. Someone may have items that you place in storage for them, and they have access to that at a later time.
Certainly. And all of those are in keeping with current laws. The courts have decided that we can't simply throw people's belongings away. And so in the ordinance, there is a provision for the storage of their personal belongings, holding on to them for a period of time so that they have the opportunity to reclaim those items when they find themselves in a little bit of a better state.
Thank you. We'll bring that back to council. Any further questions or comments by council, or I would entertain a motion on item number 5 from the consent calendar.
Make a motion that we approve a consent calendar item number 5.
I'll second.
We have a motion by Mayor Pro Tem Sturdivant, seconded by Councilman Kelly. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Councilmember Moreno?
Yes.
Councilmember Fonzie?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Sturdivant?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Thank you. Next item on the agenda is updates from the city manager.
Thank you, Mayor and council members. I have a lot of good news items ahead of you tonight, all of them, and so we'll start with Winter Wonderland, seeing as that's what's on the screen. This Friday night is Winter Wonderland, and it promises to be a fantastic one. There will be elk train rides, there will be Model A truck rides, Santa will be there, Frosty the Snowman, vendors, pony rides, and lots of amusement. So please come down and do that. And this year, in addition to our normal Winter Wonderland festivities with snow piles and sledding and all of that, we have the ice rink. The ice rink should be opening up this Thursday, I believe, and will be open for Winter Wonderland for the first time. And so that'll be an exciting night. This is a project that city staff and Mayor O'Malley was very instrumental in getting the ice rink downtown. They lost their spot up on the church on Morro Road this year, and we were really interested in keeping them here in town with a lot of hard work on a lot of people's part. We found a great spot for them this year, and we'll be continuing to look for a more permanent spot along the way, but please come down and enjoy Winter Wonderland. The holiday lighting ceremony also took place last Friday night. Again, another fantastic community event. We had the freshman choir here, the community band, the council members and Joy granddaughter of Mayor O'Malley, cut the ribbon for our brand new fountains, so we turned those back on, the restored fountains. Santa was here. A lot of people enjoyed sitting and talking with Santa. And, of course, our own City Hall was open. It was a fantastic evening for everybody. And it was a great turnout. We had more than we've ever had before, and hopefully that'll event continue to grow as people just find out how wonderful it is. Uh-oh. Okay, Luke. Well, there we go. There's Santa in the rotunda. There were some adorable pictures there that night. Saturday night, we had a holiday walk around the lake. If you haven't been to that event, it's a wonderful event. The city council serves hot cider and cookies, courtesy of the city of Atascadero, the city council, and Vaughn's. Very, very crowded booth all night. We had a fire pit going, and as cold as it was, a lot of people were interested in standing around that fire pit and getting warm along with the hot cider. I think Mayor O'Malley was there the whole night, freezing, handing out cider with a smile all night long, as were most of the council members. That was wonderful.
And we also had dog biscuits for those good dogs,
too. we talked about Winter Wonderland. Again, that's this coming Friday night. And let me go back. We had a drug bust. Several months ago, the Atascadero Police Department conducted an investigation in which a large amount of heroin was seized from a local resident. The heroin was being sold both here in Atascadero and throughout San Luis Obispo County. As a result of this initial investigation, a much larger investigation was launched, revealing a complex heroin distribution network which spanned Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara County. So it was quite a network. Due to the complexity and scope of the case, the investigation was turned over to the San Luis Obispo County Narcotics Task Force. And now the investigation has been ongoing for several months and was completed this week. The culmination of the investigation occurred when numerous search warrants were served simultaneously, two of them here in Atascadero. The warrants in Atascadero led to the arrest of one of the primary involved suspects, the seizure of a stolen handgun, and the closure of a local business that was being used as a distribution point for the narcotic sale. Overall, this was a truly remarkable case that started as the result of hard work of an Atascadero police officer. So kudos to the Atascadero Police Department and the Sheriff's Office. Good job. And with that, I'll conclude my report.
Thank you. Next item on the agenda is the community forum, an opportunity for any of you to talk on any item that is not on the agenda under which we have some jurisdiction. And we'll open up to community forum. Welcome.
Oh, I'm so nervous, but it's so good to be here. My name is Vernon Hugh Haynes, the pastor of the True Light Baptist Church in Atascadero on San Anselmo. If you never have been there, you missed your treat. But I'm so happy to be here tonight. Let us pray that God is with us. I'm not going to be long. Just give me a few seconds here. He has blessed us. And I have a saying that I get up and say every Sunday that I think is helpful to all of us when we get it into our hearts and our minds. Lord, you know you've been so good. You watched over me all night long. Lord, you've been so good. So let us pray. Our Father God, we thank you tonight for the mayor, the man who's in charge of the chief of police, and all of our workers that make Atascadero what it is today. I want to say to all of us in a prayer that this place has certainly made a big change in Atascadero. And everywhere I go, I can stand boldly and say that I am from Atascadero, California. The attitude of the people are fantastic. We are moving forward. Our city is growing. Look at where we are standing here tonight in this big, lovely, heavenly-looking place. God is just good. And we want to thank you, God, for allowing us to serve in a place where we can do something that is constructive, not just for one group of people, just for all people who is involved and live in Atascadero and those who are on the outskirts. Help us to live the life that we sing about. Let us be proud of Atascadero and thank God for our leaders, because it's not easy to lead a group of people headed in the right direction, but give them strength and give them courage because they're doing a fantastic job. Thank you so much for this privilege for me standing here, knowing who God is, and I do love God, and he loves all of us. Just look around at yourself. You can move, you can raise your hand, you can walk, you can talk. No wheelchairs. I have not noticed one in this building. That's a blessing. God is just good to us. Let us keep it up, and God is going to continue to bless us. Let us remain loving and obeying and doing the will and doing what is right to make Atascadero one of the greatest cities in California. And we're headed in that direction. God, you're so good to us. We love you. Give us strength and give us courage. Help us to be spiritual-minded people. Help us to know that we did not do it. If it had not been for God, we would be failures. But God, you're so good. We thank you. We love you. These blessings we ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you. Welcome. Next speaker.
Good evening, City Council. My name is Nancy Hare. I'm a resident of Atascadero. And I wanted to come and personally thank the City Council for appropriating the funds to do the dredging of Atascadero Lake. I am personally thanking you, and I'm also thanking you from the Friends of Atascadero Lake, a new group that is being formed to work hand-in-hand with the City Council for the ongoing improvements of the lake, and I'm also representing them. Hopefully, this will be the first of many appropriations of funds to improve the beautiful and historic Atascadero Lake. So thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Next speaker.
Mayor O'Malley, this is Jerry Clay again, 7285 Sycamore Road. Hey, if I don't get through, this is pretty important that I'm dealing with here right now, and if I don't get through, I'd appreciate it, a chance to come back for a second time. And I want to commend Gerald for, you know, breaking up this heroin stuff. It's been killing our kids. And I heard over the news that the cartel are targeting the Central Coast because it's very easy to hit their boats here. There's, you know, there's no houses along the coastline in many areas, so they're targeting us and they're putting our kids at risk. But what
Councilman,
I wanted to talk
Councilman
to you about,
Councilman Clay.
Yes.
Let's see. I don't think there's anyone else following you, so let's see if because if you go last, then we could. I would give you maybe an extra minute or so if you need. Is there any other member of the public wishing to speak during public comment? If not, we're going to close public comment after Jerry Clay, so we'll give you a little leeway tonight.
The program that we have, the Lighthouse program, is a great program. I think it's making some headways with the young people. But what's happening here is, I don't know whether you've heard the bath salts and the spice. They're sold in our head shops or our tobacco stores and even in some convenience stores. And bath salts are, you know, it's a very, you know, easy name. You think, well, somebody just Epsom salts or something like that. It's really not. It's a substance similar to speed or methamphetamines, and it creates some really bad problems, and it carries on after the person, and usually it's a young person that it gets this. And I have a boy that I was working with, and that had problems, and you know, he unfortunately went to juvenile hall because of this bath salt situation. But anyway. And then the spice is a marijuana-type product where they spray a derivative or something of marijuana on it, and it's you know, purchased too. And there's all these people out there that are trying to make money off of our young people, mostly with
preparations that they can get around the law on. But anyway, the city of Lompoc did a tremendous job. They researched this, and I heard this over Channel 12, so you know I want you to know that I heard that they were working on this ordinance for bath salts and spice, and so I was able to obtain a copy, and they did an outstanding job, and I want to pass it out to you. And I'd like to have all the city council members go to the internet and look up bath salts and spice, you know, used as drugs. And hopefully the people that are listening to this, it's a very bad. There's been 32,000 people that had to go to the hospitals because of this stuff. There's been a number of suicides, especially on the bath salts. It carries over and it creates depression. And there's been a number of suicides related to it. But this ordinance, I have it here in my hand, and it's they did an outstanding job. They really did, and we don't need to reinvent the wheel. But what I want to do is give a copy to Eric. I got 8 copies. We got 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 is 8, and you guys can look it over. I hope that you'll really give it some serious consideration. Here we go. Da, 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 da. Well, anyway, this is an outstanding ordinance. So I know Marcia's way over there. I'm just going to hand it out. And,
if you would just give it to the police chief, we'll have it distributed.
Could you please do that, Gerald?
Yeah. And we'll do that
at a later
time.
I wanted to say about Gerald and his job, certainly, let's get this heroin off the streets. And really, there's only so many policemen. We have 9,000 homes out there, and everybody's got a set of eyes. And I want to say something to the public out there, that if you see something that you're suspicious of, why, you know, don't just let it pass by. Get a hold of the police and tell them it may be nothing. And or if your son or daughter comes and says, you know, so and so is selling this stuff, you know, don't just swallow it. We're losing kids; they're dying, and get to the police, they'll check it out. And again, we all have eyes, we see stuff, and this is one of the best things we have is in our community is everybody's eyes. Is that not right, Gerald? Thank you.
Thank you. We'll have our police chief follow up on that and give us some feedback at a later date. Thank you. And I was going to close public comment, but I do want to give anyone an opportunity if there was any last comment anyone would like to make. Seeing none approach, we'll close the community forum portion of public comment and move on with our agenda. The first item we have is a public hearing, and it's regarding some administrative text amendments. And I will ask our staff, I believe it's Warren Frace, are you going to take the lead on these items?
Yes, I'll make the presentation here. This is a second reading on some amendments to our zoning code, public works code, public safety code, and building code that was reviewed by the council a month ago. So this is your second reading. So this has already been approved by the council. So this is basically a ministerial second reading. There we go on the screen there. So let's see, hang on. So there's one change that we do need to make in this. Under the zoning code, which is Title IX, there was an error in the text on the review process for the cargo containers. So we reversed Planning Commission and Design Review Committee. Okay, there you can see it on the screen there. So where it's outlined in red, where it says Planning Commission, that should actually read Design Review Committee. And where Design Review Committee is outlined in red, that should read Planning Commission. So we are recommending that the council approve for second reading the proposed changes tonight, with that one correction that we basically switch DRC and Planning Commission in the cargo container section. There was also an issue related to the extension of sewer on lots that are kind of near the city sewer system. That was part of the Title VII Public Works Code. So that item was continued. Staff, which is, will be looking at that and bringing that back for a future review by the City Council. So at this point, we won't be taking any action on the Public Works Code tonight. So that concludes staff's report.
Very good. Thank you. I'll open it up to any questions by council members. Seeing no questions by council members, I'll open it up to
Tom.
Oh, I'm sorry. Councilman Kelly.
Yeah, I think at the last meeting we had a discussion about emergency repairs to septic systems that had failed, that it was going to, you were going to look into it, that if the system was repaired under the supervision of an engineer and he signed it off as is, that would be a streamlining of an emergency situation. Is that anywhere included in here, or is that a different issue that we need to take up at a later time?
Well, it wasn't actually something that necessarily needed to be codified, but it's something that the city engineer at a staff level can implement with his review staff. So we have changed the ordinance, so there's no longer any tree protection required. So it is strictly an engineering issue. So the city engineer will be working with his staff basically to set up a process where these weekend repairs can be certified by an engineer after the work is done. So we are moving forward with that, and we don't need to change the code.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other council questions? I'll pay better attention to the lights here. Sorry, Councilman Kelly. Seeing no other council questions, I'll open up to the public for any public comment on these items. Seeing no one approach, we'll close public comment, bring it back to council for further discussion or a motion.
I'd be happy to make a motion. I move that we adopt ordinance A, C, D, and E on second reading by title only, with the proposed change between with the clerical error having to do with Planning Commission and Design Review Committee.
Second.
Thank you. We have a motion by Councilwoman Moreno and a seconded by Councilwoman Fonzi. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Moreno?
Yes.
Councilmember Fonzi?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly? Mayor Pro Tem Sturdivant?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Thank you. Next item we have, number two, is appeal of city's denial of a request for an interim management plan for the Milholland Mine. And again, this is not something brought to council by staff. This is an appeal being brought to the City Council. So I'm going to review what the process is for this hearing. First, we'll have a presentation by our staff, and then we'll go to questions by our council. We'll then have an opening presentation by the appellant for up to 20 minutes. We'll then go to public comment, where any member of the public may speak for up to 3 minutes. We'll then allow for a response by the appellate to the public comment for 5 minutes. Then we'll bring it back to council for deliberation and a decision. We'll be getting technical review by our city attorney, our city engineer, and our community development director as part of the staff report. And with that, I will go ahead and ask our city attorney to begin.
Well, thank you, Mayor. I wanted to begin with a couple of introductory comments with respect to the scope of the issues on the appeal. The city has received a correspondence from the attorneys for Mr. Milholland, Carmel and Nakasha, dated November 11th of 2013. It is attachment 26 in your packet, beginning at page 575. They are appealing the city's denial of the interim management plan. That was a decision that was made at the staff level, and they have the right to appeal that to the City Council, which is why we're here this evening. You'll be hearing more detail on that in a moment. In their letter of November 11th, they've raised a number of issues. They've raised issues with respect to the term of the operations agreement and the CUP that is in your packet. They've raised issues about vested rights, about whether there was a statement of a notice of intention to continue mining, They raised an issue about whether there are adequate financial assurances for the reclamation plan, and they also have raised issues about the processing of the SB 108 application. Now, I know that to the council and perhaps most of the audience that a lot of these terms may not have a lot of meaning now. You'll hopefully, as we go through the staff report, get additional information about that. I would mention to you that the grounds for the denial of the appeal, which is the recommendation of staff, are found in Section 9 of the resolution that you have in your packet. Those grounds are that Mr. Milholland did not provide a written notification to the city and state of its intent to continue mining is number one. Number two, that the right to mine the Milholland Quarry expired on October 23 of 2011 pursuant to the terms of CUP 96003. Number three is that there are no vested rights for continued mining operations at the Milholland Mine. Number four, that the financial assurance submitted with the revised IMP of zero is inadequate to perform the reclamation required in CUP 96003. Five is that Mr. Milholland has not demonstrated that there are commercially useful mineral reserves remaining at the Milholland Quarry. And finally, number six, that Mr. Milholland has not produced evidence to support any modified production reported on corrected annual reports. As we indicate in the resolution, any one of these, we believe, would be sufficient to warrant the denial of the appeal. Now, the reason I spent the time to go through this initially is that there may be concerns among the members of the public, including those present today, with respect to what would happen if the Milholland Mine were permitted to continue mining. Those concerns could be related to traffic issues, noise issues, air quality issues, impacts to the road, or it may be bridges in the area. I want to make clear to the council and to the public that those issues that I just mentioned are not the issues that are before the council and may not and should not and will not be considered by the council. None of those issues are referenced in the staff report or in the proposed resolution. It's not that the city is insensitive to those issues, of course, but the scope of the matter that's before you is today. So if the public wants to express those concerns, they can certainly do so, but they are not concerns that the council may consider. All right, with that, I would like to ask Mr. Frace to provide us with some background information about the Milholland Mine.
Thank you. So I'll give us a little bit of a background on the project. Let's start with the location of the mine. So this is the overall boundary for the city of Atascadero, this dark line. See El Camino Real here. Here's the downtown. The mine's located out on the west side. So here's Santa Lucia Road, this other dark line. Here's the location of the mine out there, basically on the bend on Santa Lucia Road. So if we zoom in here, you can see Llano Road and the bridge across Grays Creek's located right here. Then there's the curve in the road on Santa Lucia. The mine would be this area that's shown in red, basically fronting Santa Lucia right across from Grays Creek in this location here. This is a aerial photo that was recently taken of the area that is considered the Milholland Quarry or mine site. So the area in the dotted line is the extent of the mining boundary that was established by the 1996 conditional use permit, which includes the operations agreement and reclamation plan. You can see the areas that are being mined. So this area here is kind of the steep, slopey area that's kind of, you'll see a lot of gravel material that's visible from Santa Lucia Road. This is the road that you see cut up the slope. This is a hillside area that's more or less been reclaimed at this point. There's native vegetation growing on it. And then this ridge line up here hasn't been disturbed very much yet. This is an area that was slated for mining that hasn't been mined yet. So that's the ridge line we'll talk about later in the presentation. So a little bit of history on the mine. The mine began back in 1945 as basically a small operation. It continued for a number of decades as a fairly small operation. During the time, Atascadero was under the jurisdiction of San Luis Obispo County. The city was not incorporated until 1980. In 1980, as the city was being incorporated, San Luis Obispo County, which had overseen the mine historically, did take action to approve a reclamation plan. At that time, there was kind of a joint application process where both the city, the new city, and the county, operations at the mine began to intensify quite a bit, and neighborhood issues began to arise. At that point, there was some investigations done in terms of the status of the mine. It was discovered at that point that although the mine was within the city of Atascadero's limit, that the state still recognized San Luis Obispo County as the lead agency or the agency that was responsible for overseeing the operation of the mine. And because it was within the city of limits, that was incorrect. It should have been under the jurisdiction of the city. So in 92, the state did recognize the city as the lead agency for overseeing the mine operation. In 93, the city ordered that an amended reclamation plan be prepared for the mine. Also in 93, the council directed the quarry to be closed, recognizing that the current 80 plan that was operating under was insufficient. In 94, an interim operations agreement was approved for the site that allowed the mine to begin to operate again. At that point, there was a lawsuit filed by a neighborhood group against the city and the operator, basically challenging the 94 operations agreement. By March of 1996, there was an agreement between all the parties, which was the neighborhood group, the city, and the operator, that an amended reclamation plan would be prepared by the city. By October of 1996, the city council approved that reclamation and operations plan. That's known as Conditional Use Permit, or CUP 96003, and its title is Final Reclamation and Closure Plan. So the purpose of a reclamation plan, you basically think of mining, we're doing a surface mine, as basically a large-scale grading operation. As you grade the earth, obviously you leave scars in the earth as you remove the material. So the purpose of the Samara State Reclamation Act for surface mines is to ensure that as you're doing the removal of the material, that it's moving towards some sort of closure plan where you'll have a reclaimed site that won't be a long-term visual nuisance or any other sort of problem. So the reclamation plan is intended to ensure that by the time you're done mining, you've created a new permanent use for the site that will be consistent with the surrounding area. So in 96, we have the reclamation plan that was approved. The reclamation acres, the Mill Holland properties are bigger than that, but the 7.6 acres was the area that was allowed to be mined. The mining process would result in the ridge line being reduced, and then some of the slopes that were very steep based on the previous mining activities were to be basically reduced so they weren't as steep, so they could be more stable in the future. The way the mining operation was to occur, the idea was that heavy tractors would basically rip the sedimentary bedrock and break that down into kind of an aggregate rubble that would be pushed down to a loading zone along Santa Lucia. At the end, the site was to be reclaimed for grazing use, which is what that area historically had always been used for. The owner, Mr. Milholland, has three parcels that the mine crosses at this point. It's possible that those after reclamation could be used for residential purposes. Also, based on our zoning, it's possible that they could be subdivided down further, creating additional lots. There's nothing that would prevent the applicant from doing that in the future, and the reclamation plan acknowledged that that was a possibility, but that isn't identified as the final reclaimed use. The reclaimed use was grazing land. So in terms of what reclamation would entail at the end, the operator is required to stockpile topsoil, so the earth that can be used for growing material that's on top of the rock was to be stored in salvage piles, and that has been done. That topsoil is supposed to be spread across the site at the end of the mining operation. Then it would be hydroseeded to reestablish native plant growth as well as to control erosion. There was a requirement that 50 native oak trees also be planted across the site, and that there'd be a long-term monitoring process to ensure that these plants reestablished themselves and the site reclaimed itself. So it wasn't just a one-time planted and walk away, but you had to spend a number of years maintaining it to make sure that it did return to a revegetated site that was appropriate for grazing use. So that's what the plan anticipated. Under the state law, there's also a requirement that a financial assurance be posted with the lead agency. What a financial assurance is basically a monetary guarantee that if for some reason the mine ceases operation before reclamation is done, as intended by the reclamation plan, the operator filed his annual reports and the city did monitor compliance out there. The material was removed, and we did see an increase as construction activity picked up. The peak year for the mine was in 2005, when about 7,000 cubic yards of rock was removed from the mine. From 2006 to 2011, the mine significantly reduced its operations. Production rates dropped by more than 90% from that peak of 7,000 cubic yards a year, which is key. Under the State Bureau of Mine Reclamation, they consider that once a mine drops below 90% of its peak production rate, it falls into a category considered idle. So idle is a term defined by the state of California for a mine that's dropped to that less than 90% production rate. The key thing is when you do become an idle mine, you have 1 year as the mine operator to file what's called an interim management plan, or an IMP. The purpose of the IMP is basically to establish a new plan to allow the mine basically to sit unused for a period of 5 years, and then at some point within that five-year period to resume operation. So it's basically a way to call a timeout, basically mothball the mine for a couple years with the plan that you're going to reopen it at some point. The operator failed to file a timely IMP when his production rate dropped below that 90% level. As I mentioned, that is a state process and requirement. That isn't a city requirement. So with that, I will turn it back to the city attorney to talk about basically the status of the mine since 2011.
Thank you, Warren. I think we need to take a look at the 1996 operations agreement in paragraph 9D. That paragraph is found on page 281 of your packet, and this is part of the operations agreement, and I think it's worth the time for me to take to read this. It's not a very long paragraph, so I'm quoting now, quote D, "The removal of aggregate material from the property as provided above will be completed within 6 to 15 years in any 1 year," period, end quote. So it's clear from this language that the time limit for the removal of the aggregate material was 6 to 15 years. It says will be completed within 6 to 15 years. The remainder of the paragraph talks about the rate at which the removal was proposed to occur, but that does not change the time limit under the right to mine. So the first point we would make with regard to the operations agreement, which is part of CUP 96003, is that the right to mine ended 15 years after the operations agreement and the CUP were entered into. That was entered into in October 23 of 1996. So you add 15 years, we get to October 23 of 2011. We have in the agenda packet a letter from Mr. Milholland, which is dated October 23 of 1996. That is at page 319 of your packet. And in the letter, the first sentence reads, Dear Mr. McKinney, per your request, the owners request a 20-year extension to Section 9D of the 1996 Operations Agreement, period. Now, that was the request that was made. However, the city did not ever agree to extend the right to mine under the CUP or the Operations Agreement. In the letter from the city to Mr. Mulholland on November 1 of 2011, this is also in your packet as attachment 7. In this letter, the city advised Mr. Mulholland that mining of material would no longer be permitted. The CUP would remain in effect, however, for purposes of reclamation. You'll recall that the reclamation was one of the components of the CUP, and that's reflected in the CUP itself, which is attachment 6. Mr. Mulholland was instructed to cease mining activities immediately and requested to submit a revised reclamation plan. On February 24th of 2012, the city submitted a letter to Mr. Mulholland. The city had agreed to extend the time to submit the reclamation plan to February 16th and still had not received it. As I've indicated, the city's February 24th letter went out. The next item was on April 26th of 2012, the city submitted a letter to Mr. Mulholland reminding him that the right to mine had ended on October 23 of 2011, about the fact that the CUP provided the obligation to reclaim, that remained in effect, and the city gave a new extension, a further extension of time to submit the revised reclamation plan through July 2 of 2012. As of today, December 10th, 2013, Mr. Mulholland has still not submitted a revised reclamation plan to the city. Now let me talk a little bit about SB 108. SB 108 modified certain provisions of the Public Resources Code where the SMARA is found. SMARA is found in Public Resources Code beginning at section 2710 and following. What SB 108 did was to allow a mine operator who had failed to submit a timely interim management plan, and I'm going to refer to that from now on as the IMP, could submit an IMP. Now, the operator was required to follow the procedures that are set forth in Public Resources Code section 2775. That section is found verbatim in your agenda packet in the staff report at pages 162 to 163. And I'm going to take just a moment now to go through those requirements. I'll be paraphrasing. The exact words and the entire context are found in the statute itself. But basically, the interim management plan would be submitted to the agency, and that would then be submitted, assuming it was approved by the agency, to the state, quoting, if the lead agency confirms in writing to the department all of the following, and then there were 6 items that had to be submitted with the interim management plan. The first one was that the operator had to submit written notification to the lead agency and the director of the State Department of Conservation of their intention to continue surface mining operations. In this case, Mr. Mulholland did not do that. Secondly, that the operator must have an existing valid permit or vested right to conduct surface mining operations pursuant to section 2776, financial insurance assurance in place that the lead agency determines is adequate. In addition to that, the operator was required to demonstrate that there are commercially useful mineral reserves remaining at the surface mining operation. Fifth, that unpaid fees during which the operation status was not properly reported have been paid. And finally, that the operator provides evidence to support any modified production reported on the corrected annual reports. So those are all requirements And I probably should have had this slide up when I was reading all that, but now that I've spent the time verbally describing it, you can see it here on this slide, and I'll leave it up there for just a minute. All right. Under SB 108, a mine operation is considered abandoned due to improperly reported mineral production or status and or the failure to timely submit an IMP. It may be returned to its pre-abandoned status. For that to happen, all of the provisions of 2777.5A, which were these, must be met. IMPs that complied with the requirements of SB 108 were to be approved by July 1 of 2013. Now, what happened with respect to the interim management plan and the Mill Hall and Mine? On December 28th of 2012, an IMP was submitted by the operator to the city. On February 25th of 2013, the city found that the IMP was incomplete and requested revisions, including the need for an engineer's cost estimate of reclamation to determine the adequacy of financial assurances. And remember, those financial assurances are to make sure that the reclamation plan is properly implemented. Secondly, the need to update the financial assurances and also stormwater runoff issues. Then on April 10th of 2013, the city received a letter from Mr. Milholland's attorneys, which is in the record, indicating that they did not believe that the CUP had a fixed termination date. And recall that I read to you from the language of Section 9D, which said that it was going to be completed, will be completed, very mandatory term, within 15 years was the outside date. And in the case of Mr. Milholland's mine, it is 7.6 acres. They mentioned an ultimate goal of the construction of 4 to 6 homes. They made a statement that 50,000 cubic yards need to be removed to meet the 1996 plan. That's their position. On June 14th of 2013, the city received a letter from the state. It makes reference to the IMP submitted by Mr. Milholland. It also reiterates the 6 items that I had mentioned to you from Section 2777.5A, 1 through 6. On June 20th of 2013, the city sent a letter to Mr. Milholland denying the IMP for 2 reasons. One is that the right to the mine expired on October 23 of 2013 pursuant to the CUP and the operations agreement. I would mention, as I did previously, that the city consistently has taken the position that the CUP remains in effect to complete the reclamation. The city also denied the IMP because the financial assurances that have been submitted with the IMP were 0. That's what they said in their submission. Here is, and I know it's hard with this font to read, the text of it. It is found in your packet. But let's go to the bottom line, which is where the, I wonder if I can do this. I don't know if you can see a little red dot there, but we've got so much red going on. At the bottom here in this box, the financial assurances here were indicated to be 0. That was the cost estimate that was submitted by Mr. Milholland as to how much it was going to cost him to reclaim this property. So, this slide deals with the city's review of the cost estimate that Mr. Milholland had provided for financial assurances of 0. And I'm going to ask if Russ Thompson, the city director of Public Works, can walk us through the analysis on this slide.
Okay, thanks, Brian. Yeah, the Public Works Department did several efforts to establish what an appropriate bonding amount was. The first number at the top there, the $279,000, was a very quick initial review of the site and the amount of grading it was going to take to smooth out the stockpiles and some areas that were in pretty rough condition. That estimate was very conservative. It used the county establishing a more realistic estimate of how much dirt needed to be moved to restore the site. and apply current up-to-date figures for that estimate. So they were an independent third-party estimate, and they came up with a cost estimate of roughly $122,000 to fully reclaim the site. Again, Milholland's last cost estimate was $0, which we don't agree with, and stand behind the more conservative numbers, and the third party estimate being accurate.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. All right, now let me pick up with the intermanagement plan. On July 2 of 2013, city staff submits a letter to the state in which we indicated that we had not received Mr. Milholland's intention to a statement, a written notice of his intention to continue mining. The letter noted that the operations agreement provided that the removal of the aggregate was to be completed by October 23, 2011, that the financial assurances were inadequate. There was no demonstration that there are commercially useful materials and that the city had denied the IMP. On July 2nd of 2013, Mr. Milholland's attorneys submitted a letter to the city appealing the staff's IMP decision to the city council. On October 29th of 2013, we received a letter from the State Department of Conservation, which stated that the mine operation cannot return to a pre-abandoned status because the application is incomplete. And then on November 11th of 2013, the attorneys for Mr. Milholland submitted a more detailed letter to the city providing their arguments as to why they believed that the appeal was meritorious. Those were the arguments that I mentioned in my beginning comments and that I'll spend a little time with now. Basically, this letter raises five issues. The first one is they make an argument with respect to the term of the operations agreement. Secondly, they allege that there's vested rights. Third, they address the issue of whether there was a statement of intention to continue surface mining. The fourth issue is financial assurances, and the fifth issue is the processing of the SB 108 application. Again, this letter is found in your packet as attachment 26, beginning at page 575. So, what a packet. The word estimated doesn't appear anywhere in here. There's nowhere any statements in that paragraph that says this is an estimated life. So, I think, you know, that they're entitled to their interpretation, but I would submit to you that the clear language of the operations agreement and the CUP are that, and I'll read it again. That the first sentence from 9D, the removal of aggregate material from the property as provided above will be completed within 6 to 15 years, comma, depending on the rate at which the material is removed from the property, period, end quote. So the language is quite mandatory, and there's the clear language is that the right to mine would end in 15 years. Since this operations agreement was executed on October 23 of 1996, 15 years will put us to October 23 of 2011. Their second argument in the letter relates to the issue of vested rights, and we cover this issue in our staff report. At page 166 and 167, they point out that in section 24 of the operations agreement that there was a reservation of rights with respect to the vested rights to mine at the quarry. The first point that I would make to you, as I did in the staff report, is that a reservation of rights does not create rights which do not exist. So the mere fact that they make the statement that they've reserved rights does not itself create any rights. I would point out to you next that section 24 of the operations agreement to which they refer itself makes reference to the 1980 reclamation plan. That's the 80 reclamation plan is attachment 4 in your packet. However, that plan does not create any vested rights for a number of reasons, including but not limited to the fact that that 1980 plan was legally defective for many reasons, including, number one, that the plan did not undergo environmental review pursuant to the California Environmental Quality Act of 1970, also known as CEQA. Remember that this was a 1980 reclamation plan. The CEQA had been in effect for 10 years at that point. Secondly, that the 1980 plan and the extent of mining that was permitted by that 1980 plan was much more limited than it was as permitted under the 1996 CUP. And at this point, I'm going to pass off to Mr. Frace to proceed with a discussion on this issue of the extent of the mining allowed under the 1980 plan.
So staff put together a series of exhibits to try to show the difference between the 45, 1980, and the 96 mining limits. So this was a little difficult in part because the original 1980 plan is so schematic, it's very hard to get much detail off what they included in their application to the county at the time. But we were able to scale things off based on property lines and contours to come up with this diagram. So this is Santa Lucia Road right here. So the blue area shown here is basically what we believe was the original 1945 to probably early 70s mine area. Then the pinkish area here shown is the area that was shown as the mine area within the 1980 plan. So when they talk about the 1980 plan and the mining rights or whatever they describe it as, it's staff's belief that that is limited to this area that's shown in the purple. The area shown in yellow is the area that was added by the 96 city-approved reclamation plan. So, and we believe most of the material that is available for potentially mining exists along this ridgeline area that's shown in yellow, which is clearly covered by the 96 city plan. So the 80 plan is the area that is that fairly steep area where they push material that's collected on the other parts of the site down and then is loaded in this flat area down here. So this is a diagram that is straight out of their 1980 application, and this basically just shows in cross-section what's shown on the previous map. So this are cross-sections that they basically cut through the hills. So if you see these black lines that are shown here, those are what they call cross the ridge lines, which are the areas shown in yellow. So this is a three-dimensional exhibit that we put together on Google Earth that basically shows how those all these lines fit together. So the white line is the extent of the 96 boundary. So you can see the ridge line along here. So this is the 1,140-foot contour, is this triple line along here. So that 1980 area would be this area down here, and then anything up on the ridge line would be clearly under the 96 plan. So I'll turn it back over to the city attorney.
All right, now we're continuing to go through the letter of November 11th of 2013 from the attorneys for Mr. Milholland and the arguments that they presented there. Mr. Frace has just completed the discussion with respect to the mining area of the 1980 plan. And by the way, the narrative on that is found in your packet on page 167, and the attachments that you saw in that PowerPoint are found as attachments 27 in your packet. All right. The third argument that was presented in the November 11th of 2013 letter was whether or not Mr. Milholland had made a statement of written notice of his intention to continue the mining operations. The city, and to our knowledge, the state never received such written notice. That was a requirement of the SB 108 and specifically Public Resources Code Section 2775.5. So it is clear that this was something that was required but yet not provided. So that was the third issue. The fourth issue is the financial assurances. Now, you've heard already from Mr. Thompson with respect to the analysis that he initially did of the financial assurances based on some estimates at a number of $279,000 for the financial assurances. And then there was a third-party review of that done by Mr. Lopez of DPSI, in which he found that the number was $122,000. Both of those are six-figure numbers. They are substantially in excess of zero. In the letter of November 11th of 2013, we discussed this in your agenda packet at page 167 and 168. The letter also said that Mr. Milholland wants to, is asserting that the city wants Mr. Milholland to disturb already reclaimed land. However, in fact, what the city has asked for Mr. Milholland to do is to reclaim the property as required by law, and that has not happened. The final argument that's presented in the November 11th, 2013 letter relates to the processing of the SB 108. And I see that I've gotten behind on my slides here, so let me do a little catch up. We already talked about number four, which was the financial assurances, and how we found that the financial assurances were not adequate. The fact that they submitted the zero number and that we found that that was not adequate based upon the estimates both from Mr. Thompson and from DPSI, and that the law requires that they provide adequate financial assurances. And now I'm caught up with my slides. This is number five. This is the last argument that they presented in support of the appeal. They claimed that that the city only notified Mr. Milholland with regard to the term of the operations agreement. However, this is not the case. The city's letter to Mr. Milholland of February 25 of 2013, which is attachment 15 in the packet, advised Mr. Milholland that the IMP was incomplete and requested that he submit within 30 days an engineer's cost estimate to reclaim the property and to show adequate financial assurances, that there was a need to update the financial assurances, stormwater runoff issues, the need to indicate where and how the stormwater runoff is released, a need for the 2011 and 2012 mining operations. In addition to that, the city's letter to Mr. Milholland of June 20th of 2013 indicated two reasons for the denial of the IMP. One of them was the right to mine expired on October 23 of 2011, and the other was that the financial assurances of zero were inadequate. In addition to all of the foregoing and the grounds for the denial of the appeals, which is the recommendation of staff, those grounds are set forth in the conclusion at page 169 of your packet, which is the staff report, and they are also set forth in section 9 of the proposed resolution of denial. That proposed resolution at section 9 says that the appeal of the denial of the interim management plan is hereby denied for the following reasons, any one of which is sufficient to warrant the denial of the appeal. Number one is the lack of the written notification of the intent to continue mining. Two is that the right to mine expired on October 23 of 2011. Three, that there's no vested rights for continued mining operations. Four, that the financial assurances submitted with the revised IMP of zero is inadequate to perform the reclamation. Five is that Mr. Milholland has not demonstrated that there are commercially useful mineral reserves remaining at the Milholland Quarry. And six is that Mr. Milholland has not produced evidence to support any modified production reported on corrected annual reports. There were a couple of typographical errors for which I will assume responsibility, and they are minor, in the draft resolution. I've passed out the red line, or it's being passed out to you now. What I'm going to do now is go on the record and state what these corrections are. And there's also the red lines available for the public. Marcia, where are those found?
They're on the table where the agendas are. They're actually okay. In the right. Binder, in the pocket.
There's only a few here. In paragraph 24, the letter that I mentioned from Mr. Milhon's counsel, it is stated that it was November 11th of 2011. That should have been November 11th of 2013. On paragraph 31, there's an "and" there towards the end where it talks about intent to continue mining, and it says "and as provided by PRC 2777.5A1. There's no reason to have the "and" there. There was also one other correction, which is not in the red line, that I found from additional review. On paragraph 22, we're enumerating the request for the interim management plan, and I believe I and staff now are available to respond to any questions.
Thank you, staff. And I will go on to questions by the council, and then I'm going to get a feel for how much time we may need for public comment, and we may consider taking a break before we start, because once we start, we will finish. So we'll first go through any questions by council.
I just wanted to note that on number 24, there was, Brian, the insertion of the word "letter" after the date July 2nd, 2013, and that is on the red line copy, but just to verbally put that into the record as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councilwoman Moreno. Any other council questions? Seeing no council questions, we are ready to go to the public. I'm going to first ask the Mr. Milhullen, if you are here, if we could get just an idea of how much time you expect to take. We've allowed up to 20 minutes. Will you need the full time? Okay. With that knowledge, could I just see a show of hands of how many folks would intend to speak for 3 minutes? Very good. Thank you. I'm going to discuss with council. Would council prefer to take a break now, or shall we go ahead and proceed through? It sounds like we may need about a half hour to hear from all of the public. We've got a tough council. We're going to go ahead. So we're going to begin with asking the applicant's attorney. And we're sorry to hear about the medical emergency and agree that is a priority. So
I thought so as well. And he wanted to make sure that he wanted to be here tonight. He actually met me just a few minutes beforehand and
yeah, I think we'll have to.
Sure. I figured that much. Public sentiment. Okay, we good? Dear Mayor and City Council members, my name is John Insalabahair, and I operate. That permit had no environmental review and was pretty much a blanket license to mine. In 1996, after much debate and controversy, our client obtained a permit from the city which imposed various mitigation measures to reduce the impact of the mine on the surrounding neighborhood. With the 1996 permit, our client was allowed to extract 120,000 cubic yards of material. Now let me say that again. With this permit, he was allowed to extract 120,000 cubic yards of material, which would be extracted in a manner that is compatible with the environment and the surrounding neighborhood. That's what he was permitted to do, and that's all he's asking for today. Let him extract the remaining 50,000 cubic yards. Our client spent a lot of money on engineers, permits, surveying, and mining equipment, in order to pursue this business, and now, through this process, the city is essentially telling him that he has to throw away almost half of his inventory. That's a hard pill to swallow, and I trust you can imagine how any other business owner in this community would react if you told them that they had to do that. Now, as indicated in our letter, it's our position that the operations agreement was never established a firm termination date, and that the October 23rd, 2011 date was, for all intents and purposes, simply the estimated life of the quarry based on the anticipated rate of extraction. I encourage you to look at the background section of the CUP and read the document as a whole. You will see that the focus was on the total amount of material excavated and reaching target elevation grades. I'm sure that both sides can pick apart the language in the operations agreement to death, but that's not going to do us any good tonight. I think it's enough for us to simply say that both sides can make their arguments. The main issue, however, which is the issue that I would really like you to focus on, is the total amount of material that our client was allowed to extract. If at the time the 1996 permit was issued, our client's rate of extraction was considerably less, then the term, as the city is calling it, would be much longer, and we would not be here. Please think about that carefully. Please put yourself in our client's shoes. I imagine that what you would be thinking is, if only I extracted slower in 1996, I wouldn't be in this mess. What I'm trying to convey to you tonight is that the business model, the underlying permits for a mining operation, is focused on the total amount of material that can be excavated. The annual limitations are there in order to address the intensity of the use. If someone stops mining or slows down too much, the mine becomes idle. I do want to underscore that our client is genuinely sensitive to the neighbor's concerns. Transportation also effectively killed both applications upon submittal. With all due respect to city staff, there is very little in the way of any meaningful discussion regarding that interpretation and its drastic effect on our client. Unfortunately, SB 108 had a deadline of July 1st, 2013, and for the first time that our client really knew everything that the city believed to be deficient in their application was on July 2nd, 2013, which was one day after the deadline. Yes, the city did request updated financial assurances. However, at no point did our client ever think that the city would demand more than 23 times the amount that had been in place for the past 20 years. I hope you can all appreciate how it would feel to pay approximately $12,000 for 20 years and then have someone say that you need to now cough up $290,000 just a few days before the deadline. I do note that the city's subsequent estimate from DPSI is less than 50% of the city's originally stated amount. In our client's opinion, however, the quarry site is already reclaimed for grazing use, and he was asking for an interim management plan to be put in place. That means nothing would be excavated for 5 years. If and when soil is disturbed in the future, he would, of course, need to update his financial assurances. When I looked at the city's estimates, frustrating because much of the work that the city appears to be asking for is pretty much the same work that our client is trying to do. Instead of paying someone else to push around the dirt all at once, our client would like to do it gradually and be able to sell it for a profit. We hope that you can see the irony and the inherent unfairness in that requirement. If any of you have visited the quarry site, you will see that this isn't a big operation. It's just one medium-sized tractor and a truck to haul off the material. Our client owns a good amount of the land surrounding the quarry site, and the homes around are all rural residential. Although some of the neighbors may disagree, the reality is that this use really isn't all that incompatible with the neighborhood. And remember, it's been there since 1945. My client, Glenn Milholland, he considers himself to be a miner. That's his identity, the way he has helped support his family, and that is what he and his family have been doing for almost 70 years. Hopefully you can all appreciate and sympathize with that. All he would like to do is finish out what he started and remove the additional 50,000 cubic yards of material. I've spoken with several local people who would like to use his red rock because it's good, it's cheap, and it's just down the street. By denying the appeal, however, you're telling him that you are not allowing him to do that. You would be telling him that you are not letting him do the things the city promised him in 1996, and you would be telling him they can no longer be a miner. We hope that you see the fairness in that.
However, at the conclusion, if someone would like to speak a second time, we would allow that. Since you're being frugal with the speakers here, well, we have enough time to make sure everyone has a chance to speak. Welcome.
Hi, Mayor O'Malley, Council, staff. My name is Tom Zellner. I live at 12115 Senegal Road, out near the Mulholland Mine. And I've lived there since 1984, so I've seen all of this since the early 80s. I live about 125 yards from the mine property. I'm well aware of everything that goes on there and has gone on there. I agree with the staff recommendation to deny the Mulholland's appeal to the city, that the decision to deny the request to continue the mine operation. That's very simple, because we were thinking about all the impacts, but to stay on point, please deny the request. And I think in the future, reclamation is what we all want, and it might even be a nice open space with a hiking pass on it. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Next speaker.
Yes, I'm Jim Brenton. I live on Santa Lucia, and I just wanted to again encourage the council to support the staff in the denial of the appeal. A couple of things I'd like to bring to point. In regards to the actually the life of the of mine or the termination date of the mine, I was involved with the Santa Lucia Neighborhood Association at the time when the lawsuit was filed, and I'm sure that lawsuit would never have been settled had there not been a termination date built into the 1996 operation agreement, because that was one of the strongest things that the neighbors and the community in that time was to look at. At the time, when I look back, they were not really pleased with the 15 years because the rate of removal was set at a much higher rate, and they was wondering why it had to go to 15. Now we look at it and say it did slow down, and there was adequate time to remove that amount of material had they stayed on point at the other. In regards to the vested right, I agree with the attorney and the council in regards to the vested 1980 agreement. In fact, I personally had the site flown with a helicopter and photographed in 1994 and overlaid the 1980 with what he was currently extracting at that time, and he was already outside of the 1980 operation agreement if you looked at it from a standpoint. Didn't have the technology we have with Google Earth today.
I read the entire staff report, and I do want to compliment city staff on really fine, well-written, clear, and I will say concise report, even though it was fairly voluminous, but dealing with all the issues that they had to deal with, I thought it was right on point. And so I ask the city council to acknowledge the excellence and just plain rightness of that report by denying the appeal. Now, the city staff report rightly deals with the deficiencies in the IMP. However, there are some big picture issues associated with the reopening of the Mulholland mine, which I think is good background information at this time and maybe very important information in the future. You'll notice a number of letters that were attached to the report that spoke very clearly about some of those safety hazards associated with the mine, and I'll assume that you have read those. However, and I recall that in fact a perennial a strategic goal of the council is public safety, and this is at the heart of the reopening of this mine, in my opinion. One safety hazard that I'm not sure the council is really aware of, and I did not really see addressed in any of the in the letters from my neighbors, is the existence of a medium pressure gas line that is cantilevered off the side of that bridge right below one of the guardrails. I've spoken with both SEMPRA as well as city staff about this, and I am planning to write to the California Public Utility Commission in the hopes of avoiding another San Bruno. That guardrail, if you all have seen it, I don't think it would stop a runaway grocery cart, let alone a truck laden with gravel. So I hope you will take this information into consideration, if not now, then in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Next speaker.
Hi, I'm Ellen Barreau. I live on Laurel Road,
And when this subject first came up, I hadn't been living on that street when the controversy had happened. And they're like, you never heard of it? How can that be? So I volunteered with the neighbors to get it. It was very clear with the record that was in your staff report that the applicant had plenty of time to submit the proper forms to correct whatever needed to be corrected and get the maximum use of his quarry. And he chose not to do that. And I don't think we should feel, as a community and as a neighborhood, to feel at risk and grant him special consideration when he had the appropriate amount of time to get it all done. So I support staff's report that you should deny this appeal and put to rest the concerns of the neighborhood. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Next speaker.
Well, thank you for listening for my concerns. I missed the previous meetings here, so you have to bear with me. But I live right over the hill from that mine. I live in Galena Court. I've been there for 23 years. And I have to stop there at the corner of Lolano Road and Santa Lucia every time I go to town. And that bridge is a very dangerous area. That's my concern, really, is because the traffic that goes through that bridge, supposed to be a 25-mile-an-hour zone, but the traffic, you never know it, the way they fly through that traffic, through that bridge. And not only that, my another concern is that bridge is in desperate repair, needs a repair. And I strongly recommend that the city does something about that bridge soon, because that's just an accident waiting to happen there. As I stop there at that stop sign and I see the traffic going by, some people are very courteous, I'll have to admit. Some people are very courteous. If I'm driving home and I'm coming back home, some people will stop there at one side of the bridge and allow the other car to go through. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that there's not much room for two cars to pass there safely, and especially even at 25 miles an hour. So that's why a lot of people will just stop there at one side and allow the other person to cross. And I try to do that too for anybody that's coming the opposite way. But that's really my concern. And like I say, I live right over the hill from that mine. I live in Galena Court, right there in the cul-de-sac. And I see, I don't know how about the dust that comes from that mine, but it's never, the noise has never bothered me. And it hasn't bothered me since I've been there. The only thing that really concerns me is the safety on that road. And since I've been there, in the 23 years that I've been there, I've noticed a considerable increase and traffic.
And have been doing so for quite a few years. It makes great road base. We've always taken into account the dust and noise problems that could be created, taking the rock out, and the owner has gone overboard, I think, to make sure that anybody getting material carefully abides by the rules set by the city as to noise, dust, and time of use. If this quarry is shut down permanently, anyone needing red rock or base material west of the quarry, and there are quite a few homes west of the quarry, they still have to haul by way of Santa Lucia, creating just as much dust and noise and for a much longer distance. In some instances, the haul is going to be as far as a quarry in Cambria for a decent road base. I really think anyone complaining about the work at the quarry should be reasonable in their thinking. That quarry has been there for over 70 years and has been a source of road base for both the city and county, as well as individuals needing base for their driveways. The newcomers to the area who've come to the area in the last few years knew the quarry was there and now seem to want it gone. I've never understood that thinking. I never will. Seems to me that's the same as moving next to an airport and complaining about the jets or the airplanes. Or a feedlot or dairy and complaining about the cows. This is also a property rights issue. This man should have the right to complete his development plan. While it might be somewhat of a nuisance right now, it's only temporary. If there's an alternative, it's shutting down the mine completely and leaving it as an eyesore and a worthless piece of property. If one of the homeowners here or any homeowner wants to build an addition on their house or build a swimming pool in their backyard, doesn't that create noise and dust? It's an inconvenience to their neighbor. What do they say to their neighbor when their neighbor complains? You're going to stop the addition or stop the building? How is this situation any different? Let this man complete his development plan and get it behind us. I would say
request for the appeal to reopen the mine, and I ask the City Council to support city staff's recommendation to deny the request of the appeal by Mulholland Mine for all the reasons that have been listed here this evening, as well as the neighborhood reasons that the neighborhood has brought forth regarding safety, wear and tear infrastructure of the city property and roads, the noise pollution that would come into bear again when the mine would open up, and certainly the health reasons associated with a mining operation now in a very established neighborhood. And I do not believe that is compatible with the neighborhood, and agree that there was not a neighborhood there in 1946 when the mine originally opened, but times have changed, and I think the situation at the mine also has to change and no longer be allowed to open and operate in a neighborhood situation. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Next speaker.
Thank you. I'm Paul Rose. I've lived out on Llano Road since 1974. Going back to, and I want to thank you, council and staff, for your work. It seems to be following very much the line of the order of which this first negotiation that led to the 96 agreement came from. The neighborhood got together. That was a total maximum amount that was asked to be removed from the mine. The 20,000 yards a year was a maximum amount. It wasn't anything else. It was a maximum. The date, the deadline was set. That was very clear. I've hauled plenty of material out of that mine. I've contracted to haul material out for local roads. Santa Lucia wouldn't be there if it wasn't for that quarry. There comes a time when it changes, though. Having a few trucks come into the neighborhood to bring needed material is not near as many trucks as hauling it out would be to make your money on it. So, at any rate, I would like to bring up the issue of compliance. And compliance is one of the biggest issues. In the original go-through with the city to get the CUP, Glenn was very slow to respond to any request.
We attended many council meetings asking the city to require Mr. Mulholland to follow the mining law and protect our neighborhood. After many meetings, and I'm sorry to say litigation, everyone came to a compromise and settled their differences, concluding with the CUP and the operation agreement of 1996, listing the October 2011 as the sunset date. No one was completely happy, but we all agreed on the conclusion. We thought that that was the end of our issue and that we'd go back to our lives. Later that year, now 17 years ago, I became city clerk here in Atascadero. The next year, I applied for a full-time position in the city manager's office, and then 15 years have passed by. In September 2011, Mr. Mulholland approached the city about wanting a 20-year extension. I couldn't believe it. And he later put that request in writing, which was mentioned on October 23rd in 2011. As a city employee, I felt my historic knowledge on the issue could be helpful to the city, but I did not want my involvement in internal city meetings to cause the city any problems while the city worked through this issue. I also wanted the ability to speak on this item if it should come to that, which it has tonight. Therefore, on September 26, 2011, I submitted a letter to the city manager withdrawing myself from any internal meetings on this topic. And the city manager also responded with a letter, and I'm attaching those letters to my document here for the record. It's hard for me to believe that 20 years ago I was actually standing here talking about this same thing, and here I am again. In front of you tonight is the appeal. for staff's denial of Mr. Milholland's submittal for the IMP. The reasons that you've stated, which have been mentioned many times, is that the right to mine ended in October 2011, and the financial assurances that were submitted were zero, which are, in my mind, obviously inadequate. I completely agree with these conclusions. The 1996 agreement stated that the mine would be closed in 2011 of October. That was the whole point of agreeing to the operation agreement and dropping the lawsuit. We wouldn't have done so if that wasn't the case. Regarding the financial assurances, SMARA requires each mining operation to have financial assurances and to have them reviewed annually to determine what amount is needed to reclaim that mine if the person should walk away that year, for example. And the 11,000 plus that was put in by Mr. Milholland was from way back, even before 96. And even at that time, during all the litigation, it was argued that that wasn't enough. So to say that that was never brought up before is not true. He denied and refused to do it even way back then. I support staff's recommendation, and I urge you to adopt the draft resolution that's been recommended to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome, next speaker.
Edward Vick. I own a home on Santa Lucia Road on this side of the bridge, so I would be affected by this also. It seems like I'm outnumbered by a considerable, but I don't have a concerted effort to try to promote the Mulholland Mine. But I do have a reference to the person. I have had the honor of meeting a Mr. Mulholland about a year and a half ago, and over that time I've had a tour of what he was trying to do with the property. From what I was under the impression was there was about 50,000 cubic yards, I guess it is, of material that still needed to be removed in order to make it accessible and to regrade the slope of the hill so that it could be used and fire trucks could get up for a development if you wanted to put a house up on top. And I believe the man. He's a very honest and very gentle man. Over the time that I've been up there and looked at the property, I've also heard some of the problems that he's experienced, one of which is he was stopped from removing material. He has been stopped from selling material on different occasions. There was a road that was supposedly going to go in, and I don't remember the exact name of the road, but he wanted to supply material to it. But when he talked to the existing city council at that time, he was told that it would be a cold day somewhere below us before he would ever be allowed to move any material out of that quarry. So he's been thwarted over and over and over again from removing material and operating the mine. I also know that there seems to be someone that has had a concerted effort who's been working with this board, working with the city council, and kind of in the background promoting the elimination of the mine. I guess you can be a member of the city employees and still have a people's right to complain about something. Because in April, I was notified by a neighbor, a friend, that there was going to be a meeting on the quarry. And I thought, well, gee, I'd like to go see what they're talking about. And you'd be surprised at what all of the complaints were. There was a complaint of one gentleman. The noise bothered him, and he lived on a hill about two hills away.
Good evening. My name is John Ellis. I live at 9540 Galena Court. And I'd like to thank staff and the city attorney for presenting an excellent overview and case history. And to me, it's quite apparent, based on the facts and the evidence presented, that the appeal should fail, you know, based on legal facts and the law. So I would support the city attorney and the staff on their great job and would recommend that the appeal be denied. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the public that would like to speak for the first time? If not, I would open it up. If anyone who's spoken would like to speak for a second time, I would allow that at this time. After that, we will be closing public comment, allowing the appellant here to have a response to the public comment, then we'll be bringing it back to council. So welcome. Next speaker. Second round.
Just a little clarification. Mr. Mulholland did not show up tonight because of his wife's illness. I have two housemates of mine that are, one of them was raised here in Atascadero. They're helping with Mr. and Mrs. Mulholland right now, and they would have been here on his side also. So it's not a false flag there.
Thank you. And thank you for that input. Any other member of the public wishing to speak? Because we will close again with the attorney for the appellant and making some remarks, and there will not be further public comment after that. So any other comments? Seeing none, we'll close public comment and allow the response by the appellant to the public comment for up to 5 minutes. Welcome.
Is this the right one? Okay. First, I'd like to thank staff and thank City Council for your time tonight. I don't think anything I have to say right now is directly in response to any of the comments. I would like to underscore, I forgot your name, sir, but about Mr. Mulholland and how much he does care about the property, cares about the community, and he is a kind and gentle man. He does want to do what's right, you know, for the environment. The way that he intends to operate his mine and operate and the finished product for the property is what's in the best interest of the community, and I do want to make sure that you guys...
I have been on council, I think when this was heard some years ago when I was first on council, is my primary experience with this item before coming to this meeting. And, of course, I've known our city clerk for that entire time, and this is a topic where we have not discussed, and she has been honorable on her... presentation that she has not provided input to council, at least in my experience. So thank you. I'm going to bring it back to the city attorney again to review. You've heard public comment. I heard references to fairness, danger, compatibility, pollution, infrastructure, many items that would normally be items the council would consider on an issue. However, those are, I understand, are not items that would be recognized in this appeal. Could you review that or clarify that in our understanding?
I'll be glad to do that. I think Mr. Kresblock, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name right. I know his first name was Mike. He used the word neighborhood reasons in his statements, and I think that that's a good description of what we heard from a number of the speakers tonight, health-related issues, dust, noise, road safety, some of these other items that were mentioned by other speakers. And I would collectively call those neighborhood reasons. I think that's a good description. As I indicated in my opening comments, and not to minimize those reasons, but just to put that into perspective, that the issues on this appeal, you should not be considering the neighborhood reasons. You should focus your attention solely on the materials that were submitted in the staff report and the attachments to that staff report. I went in some detail, as did Mr. Frace and Mr. Thompson, into the background facts, the applicable law of the Public Resources Code, the requirements of the Public Resources Code in terms of what had to be included in the interim management plan, and the fact that that information was not provided. And it was for that reason that the resolution that you have in front of you with the red line version was submitted to you, because it supports our recommendation that the appeal be denied. And I can certainly...
And the bridge safety, the bridge railings, is not at issue tonight, but we still stand behind the cost estimates that were done, and that's really the only thing that I heard.
Thank you. Mr. Frace?
No additional comment.
Thank you. This time I'm going to ask council just for clarifying questions, then we'll go into a time for deliberation and decision. So are there any questions from council first for staff? Councilwoman Moreno.
I'm wondering if the city attorney, could you clarify the reclamation costs of, you know, just under $12,000 back in 1996? And one of our speakers referred to the law requiring that every year that be updated. So we get from 12,000, and I realize that the applicant has given a financial assurance of zero because they're asserting that it is reclaimed, but the city's saying that no, we need assurances in 279, 121 from the 12. So from 1996 being at about 12,000, how does the law work in terms of requiring like an annual update to whatever those costs might be anticipated?
I'm looking for the slide that describes the reclamation. Here we go. This slide is entitled 1996 Reclamation Plan, and this comes from attachment 6 in your packet. Mm-hmm. And it's a summary of what would be required under the 1996 Reclamation Plan to salvage topsoil, hydroseeding and erosion control, native plant reestablishment, the planting of 50 oak trees, and the revegetation for grazing land use. And remember that we're talking about 7.6 acres. I do not know how that $11,874.29 was calculated. It apparently was included in the 1996 plan. However, the SB 108 required, as well as other laws, that the financial assurances be other analysis was done of the reclamation plan requirements, and the estimate was given of 121. Whether the number is 121 or the number is 279, we know the number is north of $100,000, and it is not zero. So the financial assurances that were proposed by Mr. Milholland with the IMP were clearly on their face inadequate. And so that was inconsistent with SB 108, and that supported the city's decision to deny the proposed IMP. I heard comments from counsel for Mr. Milholland that the real reason was that the CUP had expired in 2011. Well, that was certainly one of the reasons, but another reason was that the financial assurances were inadequate, as well as the failure to comply with the other requirements of SB 108. So I hope that answers your question.
It does. And it's not that the CUP expired, it's that the term expired, but the CUP continued with the reclamation.
Yeah, if I said the CUP expired, I misspoke. Yes, that's correct. The right to mine under the CUP expired on October 23 of 2011. The CUP remains in effect until the reclamation is completed. Mm-hmm. So the city has not terminated the CUP. I think perhaps in one of the letters we saw from the attorneys from Mr. Mulhall, and they were talking about that we had terminated the CUP. We didn't terminate the CUP. We just made it clear to Mr. Milholland and his lawyers that the right to mine ended by the terms of the CUP on October 23 of 2011. They also made reference to the fact that there needed to be a public hearing with respect to the CUP. Well, we are having a public hearing tonight, so I don't believe one was necessary since we didn't terminate the CUP, but we are having a public hearing. This certainly is an opportunity for Mr. Milholland and the public to weigh in on that issue.
Okay, and then I had one other question, if I may.
Yes.
The attorney for Mr. Milholland said that the way he views it is that the term was, you know, estimated, which I know that you've gone through that paragraph, and it says it will end, and so that to me seems pretty clear. I would like maybe your take, because he's saying that the emphasis really in the 1996 plan is on the amount to be excavated. So he seems to be putting a lot of emphasis there versus the term, and I'm wondering if you would speak to that.
I'd be glad to. If you look in your packet at page 280, this is attachment 6 of material from the property. This amount may fluctuate but will remain consistent with the final landform plan, phasing plan, and reclamation plan. So there was an acknowledgement in the agreement that that was a number that could fluctuate. Now, put that into perspective with the subsection D, which the first sentence, which I've read a couple times, makes clear that the removal of the aggregate, quote, will be completed within 6 to 15 years. The second sentence of that section talks about it is anticipated that the property owner's principal operator shall remove material at the rate of 20,000 cubic yards per year until the reclamation has been completed. So if I'm not really good at math, but 6 years at 20,000 would be 120,000. And I see you're nodding and you have accounting background, so I'll assume that's verification of my math. So obviously, if they were going to be removing something less than 20,000 per year, it might take them more time. But there's nothing in the operations agreement or in this paragraph that says that there's any assurance as to the total amount of cubic yards that could be removed. It is merely a statement that they anticipate that that's the quantity they will remove. In contrast, there is a very specific statement about how long they have to remove however much they end up removing, and that is 6 to 15 years.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, we are continuing on with council questions at this time. Councilwoman Fonzie.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. A question regarding the CUP and SB 108 and the particulars of this. Are there any time frames for beginning or completing the reclamation in the CUP or SB 108?
There's not an SB 108. SB 108 is an opportunity for them to return to an idle status. And I don't believe that there's anything in there about a time period to complete the reclamation. And in terms of the CUP's requirements for completing the reclamation, I don't offhand recall that there was an end date for that. Perhaps I could seek some assistance from Mr. Frace if he happens to remember if there's an end date for the completion of the reclamation.
Mike?
To the abandoned or idle status, you must then go directly into reclamation.
Very good. Then, Mr. Frace, I'd like to ask a follow-on question. I think you may be the one that could answer, but it may be the city engineer or attorney. The attorney for the mine owner stated that reclamation was not possible without removal of approximately 50,000 cubic yards of the material. Could you explain how reclamation could be possible if the appeal is denied?
Yeah, what would have to happen is the reclamation plan that currently anticipates that 120,000 cubic yards of materials removed, we would need to amend that reclamation plan to acknowledge that we haven't removed that much material. The main thing is there are some slopes there that are too steep that would need to be laid back. There's some stockpiles of topsoil that need to be spread. But mainly what needs to happen to the site is it needs to be revegetated, and then that revegetation needs to be monitored for establishment over a period of time. So that's mainly what's going to be involved in reclamation. Most of the site that hasn't been mined won't need to be reclaimed. If you don't mine it, there's nothing to do. So leaving the ridge line in its natural condition does not make reclaiming the mine harder. It makes reclaiming the mine much, much easier.
So this one's for Russ. When you did your estimate of the reclamation cost, was that mainly for revegetation, or were you thinking there'd be more earth moving?
No, we definitely thought there was going to be more earth moving. So initially, in the first estimate, we had made the assumption of about 15,000 yards of smoothing out. I mean, I think we've all been by the site, and it looks, you know, like the surface of the moon. So there is a lot of smoothing, and like Warren said, there's some piles and some steep slopes that need to be flattened out. So the initial estimate was up around 15,000 yards. The third-party estimate did a little more work, a little more analysis on the existing areas that needed to be sloped back. They came up with 7,100 yards of soil moving. And so that's roughly half of the cost that was included in the first estimate. But the estimate does include revegetation, hydroseeding, some temporary irrigation to get that established, erosion control measures. So just not very elaborate, but and the 50 trees that were required to be planted too.
Okay, so one last question. When you say earth moving, then you're talking more of the topsoil.
Comment about the overall CUP language being based or focused on the yardage taking off of the property. Can you speak to that, please?
Yeah, I believe the comments that I made in response to the questions from Councilmember Moreno here would apply, that there were statements of anticipated quantities to be removed in the operations agreement. However, those were just anticipated, and they were maximums, it appears, from the language and the context of it. The one thing that is clear is that there was no statement about the number of years of 6 to 15 being anticipated or estimated. The language in 9D clearly says that that will be 6 to 15 years it'll be completed. So that's unequivocal in my opinion.
Thank you.
Councilman Kelly.
Yes, this would be for the city attorney. If you could go to page 235, please. This is the 1980 reclamation plan. It has a certification of vested mining rights. And if you go to the next page, 236, it says intermittent operations, and it has a description of what that is. Is there any type of grandfathering clauses or anything that take precedence over the 1996 plan or what have you?
No, I do not believe so. I've indicated why I don't believe that the 1980 plan created vested rights. That's outlined in some detail in the staff report at pages 166 to 167. I noted, among other reasons, that the 1980 plan had not complied with CEQA, which was adopted in 1970. So the 1980 plan came into effect 10 years later with failing to comply with CEQA, so I believe it was legally defective. It did not comply with SMARA, which was adopted in 1975. There were no state review or approvals involved with that, and there was no public notice of the proposed plan. So for all of those reasons, when you have a plan that's defective, there wouldn't be any vested rights that would arise from that. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the 1996 CUP, it in fact addresses the fact that this any future mining would be governed by the 1996 plan rather than the 1980 plan. So I think all of those are reasons which support the conclusion that there are no vested rights.
With all California and federal law that is implemented as it progresses through time, we just recently adopted even more requirements by the Regional Water Quality Control Board that I assume apply to any project. It just seems to me that over time the cost to restore this property would be increasing rather than declining. And is that a reasonable assumption? And then I would like the city engineer to speak to that to some degree if that is a valid question.
Well, let me answer the first part of that. You said that there has to be financial assurances, and that's almost complete. There have to be adequate financial assurances,
okay,
which is an important word, because I think that most of us, except for perhaps Mr. Milholland, can agree that zero is not adequate. I've left the PowerPoint slide on the screen that I read from earlier about what this reclamation would require in terms of the topsoil, the hydroseeding, the erosion control, the oak trees, the revegetation, and all of this of 7.6 acres. We're not talking about a small piece of property. This is not a one-acre site. It's 7.6 acres of doing the things that I just listed need to be done. So for there to be adequate financial assurances to do that, we've had the Director of Public Works give his estimate. We went and got a third-party estimate. It was still a six-figure number, $120,000. So it's very clear that there were not adequate financial assurances. With regards to your comments about California and federal law and the Regional Water Quality Control Board. Yes, there are federal laws, and yes, there are water quality laws. However, those laws are not before you tonight. What is before you tonight are those provisions of the Public Resources Code with respect to the requirements that had to be included in the IMP, and those are set forth in the resolution that I referenced to you a couple of times now. And those are the bases for you to take action tonight in terms of whether you're going to follow the staff recommendation to deny or whether you're going to uphold the appeal.
Thank you for that clarification. If I could have the city engineer address, perhaps we have that slide for the 100,000 range of cost estimate, and you may well have answered this, but that is primarily for the regrading of the existing material, and is that it? Is that the current estimate of cost to provide what was originally believed would cost about 12,000 under?
Or? I think I can only surmise that the original estimate of 11,000 that bond, and we want to restore it from where it is today. So certainly the cost over the last 20 years have increased, the complexity of Water Quality Control Board, erosion control, just all costs in general are much higher now than they were 20 or 25 years ago. So it doesn't surprise me that the cost estimate's substantially higher. And I think the conditions are fundamentally different than maybe the assumption, 20 years ago where they would be in 2011.
Thank you for that point. Any other council questions? I'll open it up to for just discussion, comments, or a motion.
I'll make the motion. If there's no discussion, I move that the council approve draft resolution A, resolution of the City Council of the City of Atascadero, California, denying appeal of denial of interim management plan.
Second.
And that would be with the red line changes and the other
correct
changes that I mentioned.
Yes.
That's agreeable by the second. So we have a motion by Councilwoman Fonzi, seconded by Mayor Pro Tem Sturdivant. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Fonzi?
Yes.
Councilmember Moreno?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Sturdivant?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Thank you. And I would think we probably want to take a break. And I would thank all of you for your polite interaction with us. We appreciate that and helps us get to a conclusion. We'll take a 10-minute break. We just completed item two. We're moving on to item three, which is the Dove Creek Commercial Center amendment to condition number 10, Santa Barbara Road and El Camino Real. We'll go ahead with a staff report.
Yes, thank you, Mayor, Council. This item before you, as you mentioned, is an amendment to the Dove Creek Commercial Center. Specifically, condition number 10 we'll be looking at tonight. So, a little background on Dove Creek. 2004, the master plan of development was approved by the City Council. This is the overall layout of it. Most 79 housing units and then a 60,000 square foot commercial center. So 60,000 square feet is the retail square footage that would be allowed on the site. The site's actually a little bit bigger than that, or it is a lot bigger than that. It's about 5.5 acres. So condition number 10 was added by the City Council to incentivize the commercial development of the site. One thing to keep in mind, before 2004, this entire Dove Creek site was zoned commercial. So we had about 60 acres of commercial there that was intended for regional commercial center. So when it was rezoned to primarily residential in 2004, there was a concern at the city council level that there was a potential loss in long-term sales tax revenue. And in terms of the trade-off for making that change to residential, the council wanted to make sure that we incentivized building at least a small commercial center in the short term. So that was the purpose of condition number 10. Most recently, the council has looked at this site in this year as an economic development hotspot in terms of area that we want to focus some energy in terms of encouraging commercial development. Fortune Companies, their representative Ben Efren, who's the applicant tonight, is in the audience. They are in escrow to purchase the property, but they do need some amendments made to Condition 10 before they'd be able to close on the property. So a little background on Condition 10. Condition 10 did three primary things. The first was it created a $400,000 sales tax in lieu account. And the agreement was that for every year that a 45,000 square foot permits for a 45,000 square foot shopping center weren't issued, that the city could withdraw $40,000 a year in money, basically sales tax, that we didn't get from a project, and move that into our general fund. So we've been doing that for a number of years, and there's a couple draws that still remain in that account. As I mentioned, it requires at least 45,000 square feet of commercial permits to be issued, and the final penalty for not basically moving forward with the commercial center was that the property would then transfer back to the city of Atascadero on July 1st, 2016. So that would be the penalty if the 45,000 square foot center permits were not issued. So here's the aerial photo of the site as it exists today. It's a graded pad. It's planned. You can see a Tractor Supply is basically what's called Major A there on the corner. Then the perimeter of the site against the residential area would be smaller freestanding retail office type spaces with a central parking lot. In terms of the review of this issue, in terms of this amendment, we've run this through a couple different levels already. So as I mentioned, the council looked at this in September as a potential hotspot area where we needed to focus some energy on. The council direction was to take Mr. Efren's proposal to change Condition 10 to the Design Review Committee for review. That was done in October. The Design Review Committee did recommend that we move forward with changing Condition 10. That was then forwarded to the Planning Commission in November, so they've reviewed this, and they are now recommending tonight that we do move forward with these changes. We've been working fairly closely with the city attorney on this. There's some legal issues related to condition number 10, so the city attorney has been part of the development of these amended conditions, as well as there's a memorandum of development that's recorded against the property that would then need to be terminated at some point, so that's also included in the conditions of approval. The existing 2009 master plan with the site plan and the architecture remain in effect. So we're not changing anything in terms of the site plan or the architecture tonight. The idea would be that Mr. Efren would move forward with that project. If for whatever reason there's a tenant that needs changes, there would be an amendment process at a later point that could occur to accommodate a specific tenant. So in terms of the changes that are proposed to Condition 10, the city would still be entitled to draw down the remaining sales tax in lieu account. So we would be able to collect the remaining money that's in the account. We would add a clarification that there's no requirement to add any additional funds to that in a lieu count. So that $400,000, once that is exhausted, that requirement goes away. We would remove the property transfer requirement. So if a shopping center of 40,000 square feet didn't start construction, there would be no requirement to transfer the property, so Mr. Efren could own the property indefinitely. It clarifies that you could subdivide the property further for commercial purposes, which is typically always allowed in commercial to move forward with trying to develop a commercial project there. It would remove the condition that the property transfer to the city in 2016, and it should increase the likelihood that the private marketplace can now take action to move forward with development of this property. As I mentioned, the Planning Commission has reviewed this. They are recommending approval, so we have a draft resolution A that's in your staff report that includes all the changes to Condition 10 as we mentioned. That'll conclude staff's report.
Thank you. I'll look to the lights for council questions, beginning with Councilwoman Fonzie.
Thank you. Warren, I noticed in the report that we had a 5-1 decision from the Planning Commission. Could you tell me if you know what the one person's objections were?
Yeah, one of the commissioners was concerned that the city might be able to negotiate a better deal, I guess, basically by asking for some sort of additional development guarantees or something of value to the city in exchange for making these changes. So it wasn't real specific, but I think the general discussion was that we're removing conditions that then make the property more valuable, and somehow the city should benefit more from removing these conditions that are burdening the property.
Thank you.
Thank you. Councilman Kelly.
Can we discuss this now, Tom, that item that Mrs. Fonzie just brought up, since we don't have a crowd here? I have some concerns. I don't know what format you want to follow.
Yeah, we should not get into deliberation now. We're still doing clarifying questions now. We'll get into public comment. After we close public comment, then it's appropriate to get into discussion of opinions or thoughts. So let's limit to questions at this point. Any clarifying questions of staff report?
Has there ever been an evaluation on the value of that property, like an appraisal or anything for the best use and what the market value of that property may be to relate it what the value might be in 2016 if the city were to take it back?
Staff hasn't seen one, so there may have been one done privately, but staff has.
Thank you.
Councilman Sturdivant and Councilmember Kelly.
Yeah, Warren, if we did get to 2016, is there any legal wrangling with this property being, you know, the city taking ownership of this property? Is there any kind of legal issues with that?
I think I'll refer that to the city attorney.
I thought that what we had done was modify the documents to provide that the city wasn't going to the property was not going to be reverted to the city.
Yeah, I think the question is what would happen if we didn't and the city tried to acquire the property?
Well, yeah, there's some question about whether or not that was legally, could happen legally, which is why we have modified that.
Thank you.
Councilman Kelly and then Councilwoman Moreno.
If we get to July the 16th and the property does revert back to the city and there is no tax sale before that, does the city have to pay property tax if they take title to it?
Rochelle, can you answer that?
It is my understanding that the tax lien has to be cured regardless of who would take over possession of the property, including the city. So if the city were to receive title to it or to purchase the property, it's with the tax liens on it.
Thank you.
Councilwoman Moreno.
So if it went to tax sale, how does that work, Director Frace? Is that where they say, okay, the tax the tax lien is $330,000, and so that's like the bottom price, and it can only go up from there? Or is it, and is it the county that does it, and they say we'll take whatever we can get? How does that work? And then would that be released, and then it would kind of start over at zero, and then whoever bought that would have a year basically to get permits pulled and moving?
Yeah, it's my understanding that it's a basically an auction that happens at the courthouse steps, and I don't know if they have a starting bid, but I think they try to get as much as they can, and then it's my understanding that then they transfer it to the new owner, and the taxes are cured at that point.
And you said that's slated for early spring. What did you say?
We understand it's scheduled for spring of 2014. Piece of commercial property that's fully improved. So even with those conditions on it, it would have some value to someone, I would imagine.
Okay. Thank you.
Councilman Kelly, followed by Councilwoman Fonzie.
I believe tax sales become valid after 5 years of not paying taxes. And I think there's a history in this county that normally the properties don't go up for sale at that five-year period, that there's usually a additional lapse of time. Are you aware of that? Or I think you mentioned it was already scheduled for a tax sale. Is that something that's is documented?
We've had some conversation with the county tax collector, and it's our understanding that that is their plan, is to schedule it for a tax sale this spring. So I think there is I think that back taxes go back to like 2006, so I think they're already past 5 years in terms of back taxes.
Councilwoman Fonzie?
It's a question for the city attorney. If Mr. Efron's request is granted and we do an amendment to Condition 10 and remove the memo termination to clear the title, would there be an expense to the city to prepare that paperwork?
I don't know that there would be significant expense associated with that. There have been expenses which have been incurred to date in connection with the work by our office on this matter. And I have that estimate for you if you're interested.
Yes, what would that estimate?
That amount that I checked was $4,080. There were substantial discussions and drafts that went back and forth, communications with the attorney for Mr. Efron as well.
And this would be work that you would do?
That's work that has been done.
Got it. Thank you.
That was done by myself and by Greg Murphy of our office.
Thank you. Councilwoman Moreno.
For the city attorney, so if this property did get sold at a tax sale, does the city's claim to it as of July 1, 2016, if permits aren't pulled, does that follow through with any tax sale, any sale period?
I'm not sure if I know the answer to that question, so I'd have to research it.
Okay.
Would like to speak, or in any other member of the public, we'll let you go first.
Good evening, everyone. I'm more here to be available to answer any questions that a member of the public or any of the council members would have.
Okay, thank you. Well, we could, are there any questions for Mr. Efron at this time? Councilmember Kelly.
I'm sure you've done a study for this property, and what do you think the potential is to build the 60,000 square foot of commercial property down there, to be successful doing it in Atascadero?
In my opinion, and based on the research that we've done in the last 6 months that we've been involved with this property, is that the likelihood of being able to develop 60,000 square feet of retail with the current economic climate and with the feedback that we've initially received, the likelihood of 60,000 is not very high. I think we can probably do 10, 15, 20,000 square feet and perhaps increase that. A lot of it really depends on outside factors that are not in our control. It's a large amount of square footage for an unusual part of town. But we're very bullish, and we think we can make the site far better than what it is as an empty, vacant site that's been there for almost 10 years. Our expertise is tackling challenging projects and being creative and accomplishing what a lot of people, a lot of developers decide to pass on.
If you were only to develop the 20,000 square feet, do you have a backup plan what your intentions would be with the balance of the property?
What we'd like to move forward with initially is to find the right kind of anchor tenant, a retailer, a hospitality type business, and have them situate themselves on the site and build the rest of the project around them. And conceivably, it would be primarily a retail project.
Any type of housing component on the back shelf in case the commercial project can't be fulfilled at 60,000 square feet?
This is a good question. It's a question that Councilman Fonzie had asked, and we had approached this project initially with a mixed use, having about 20,000 square feet of retail and the balance of it being rental housing or condominiums. At this time, we'd like to proceed with a commercial component. We think there's a good chance that we can accomplish that goal. We're not looking to acquire the property with residential in mind. We're going to try the commercial avenue.
Thank you.
Any other council questions?
Thank you. We may have a dialogue with you here in a moment, but I'm just going to check for the sake of protocol. Is there any member of the public wishing to speak on this item? And seeing no one come forward, I'm going to close public comment. We will keep it open that we may have some further questions for you, and I'll bring it back to council for some deliberation.
Certainly.
Thank you. I would say, again, when this project first came before the council, I was one of those, and many were disappointed that we lost so much commercial property. I thought, actually, one of the original designs that was proposed was very good, but it didn't happen. And so this was a compromise that I think we had a split vote on it when I suggested I was concerned about getting some component of commercial actually built. And at the time, folks were confident that they could go ahead and build some commercial. I had been on council long enough to know that that doesn't always happen. So we negotiated, well, okay, if that doesn't happen, could we capture the revenue that we would have gotten had this been fully built as commercial? So that's where we reached this agreement. Our finance director at the time came up with this amount, and it was actually fortunate for the city that we've generated $40,000 a year during a pretty down time in the economy, and had it actually been built commercial, it's not likely they would have been fully occupied in any case. So I think we did pretty well as a city. And then when you look at tax liens and other things, I think this is a good proposal by staff, and I could certainly support this. We may want to talk about some different modifications, but I'm going to open it up for discussion by council and a possible motion, but let's allow some time for discussion first. First, Councilman Kelly, then we have a lot of folks, so take it away.
Right. I just had an eye-opener, I guess, in the last week or so, and I'd like to preface it that I do represent the city on a lot of the homeless committees and affordable housing committees and what have you, and kind of up to date on some of the problems with getting affordable housing. I think in realistically, I don't think we'll ever see 60,000 square feet of commercial property down there. I think the tractor company figured that out, that it wasn't going to work. I praise Mr. Ephraim for, you know, wanting to put some commercial down there, but I truly don't think that's going to happen, especially within the future when we have the Hoff property, we got the Colony Square, we have the annex and the Walmart that might be a little more advantageous to developers. So I think before it's all over with, I think at some point in time there'll be a request to put some housing in on that property. I'm not quite sure about the tax status and the time frame, but I'm just wondering if we might be giving too much away. Because if we were able to acquire that property just for the tax amount, and if the city really, really cared about affordable housing, I think we could partner up with some larger organization and have a pretty nice affordable housing project, something similar to what Paso Robles has up on their north end of town. You know, it's just something to throw out there and think about. And, you know, it's a little over 5 acres, I think, on today's market. It's probably worth in the $1.5 million range or somewhere in there. So I'm just wondering if we're maybe making the right decision here, or if maybe we need to maybe sit on this and get a little bit more information, what were different options that we might have.
Thank you. Councilman Fonzi, followed by Councilman Moreno.
Maybe I'm an optimist, but I think with Eagle Ranch as a possibility in that area, I think it's actually a fairly strong commercial area in the near future. I don't think it's compatible for affordable housing with the Dove Creek subdivision. I can see money to do the amendments to Condition 10. And it's not a great deal of money, but we have always stated as a council that we wanted our applicants to pay their own way. It's $4,080. I would support this personally with that addition that the applicant was to pay that particular bill.
Thank you. We have Councilman Moreno, followed by Council Mayor Pro Tem Sturdivant.
Thank you. I was glad to hear Mr. Ephraim say that his first, that he's honestly going to be pursuing the commercial, and I take him at his word with that because I do think that's an important component. That's the original intention, and as Councilmember Fonzi said, with Eagle Ranch, you know, as a potential, I think we need to kind of keep that long term, like not just what does the market bear today, but as things are improving and as we do have that potential at the south end of town, I think we need to keep open to the idea of commercial. But I am curious if I'm to follow this process out, if there's a tax sale, let's say May, and assuming that the city's right as of July 1, 2016 would remain the same, we are giving up a lot. Because essentially, if somebody bought it, the tax lien would be relinquished, and all you'd have is a year of taxes, which presumably whoever buys it would pay those taxes. And obviously have an incentive to pull permits and get something going, knowing that they've only got a year to do that or it reverts to the city. If it did revert to the city at that time, we'd basically have it free and clear, and not that we would be looking to develop, but could potentially sell it something of that manner. So that tax sale, that was new to me, so that kind of starts entering in that we might be giving up a lot.
Councilman Sturdivant.
Well, in looking at the report, you know, it talks about the DRC taking a look at this and the Planning Commission, so it's been looked at and discussed. And the thought that goes through my mind is, are we giving something up? And the answer from our attorney was saying that it's problematic to take ownership of this piece of property. Whether it's a tax sale, whether we want to get into spend the money for this property when we have someone who's willing to pay, who wants to buy the property, develop, which is going to get us property taxes, sales tax.
And so if we were to take over the property, the first thing we would do is pay back that tax lien, and we get a value of about, you know, we've gotten $400,000, we've spent $330,000 on the taxes.
No, I understand that, but if I'm understanding this correctly, if in, let's say, April or May, there's a tax sale, and, you know, Jane Smith buys the property from the county for, let's say, $500,000. I don't know what it would be. But the tax lien, or $200,000, it doesn't matter what the amount is, that tax lien is then gone, and Jane Smith owns the property free and clear of any tax lien. Is that how that works, Director?
That's my understanding. Rochelle, is that your understanding?
Could I actually called the county last week and was unable to get a clear answer on that. They said, well, we'd have to have the attorneys look at it, and everybody's at a conference this week, of course. and so, because I was trying to get it pinned down, and I would have liked to have seen it in writing. That would be my general understanding, and I think Brian should probably weigh in. Sorry, we keep passing the buck around. But this is certainly not our area of expertise, and we're trying to rely on others to find out what it is. It is what I've heard from the past is that, you know, when it's sold at the county steps, whatever the proceeds are, that wipes out the tax bill, but I'm not positive of that.
Well, my understanding, to enter yet another opinion, is that when they have the tax sale, I believe that there are other bidders that could bid a price in, so that if there was some proceeds above the taxes that came in, let's say the taxes were $300,000, and somebody came in and wanted to buy the property for you know, there's some competing bidders, and the winning bid ended up being $1 million. The way I understand it is, of that million, $300,000 then goes to pay off the taxes, and then the person that lost the property, if you will, to the tax sale would receive the incremental $700,000. Now, that's a general understanding. I haven't researched it. I'm not sure, but that sounds like it would be the right answer. If you wanted a definite right answer, I'd tell you that I'm going to have to look into it and get back to you. I don't know that it makes a difference in how you should proceed tonight. I've indicated to you that I believe the requirement that this property revert to the city is legally questionable as to whether or not that is proper. And so I think it's based on that, based on what I believe is probably the rule, that if it goes to tax sale and the highest amount, let's say the taxes are $300,000, and they only get a bid of $200,000, then I guess it would be up to the county if they wanted to accept $200,000, because $200,000 is more than zero.
Right.
To go back to an earlier meeting we had.
That goes back to my point, though, is that if that was wiped out with a buyer next spring, then that tax lien is gone. So we wouldn't be taking on that tax lien July 1 of 2016 if it came to that.
Well, another scenario is, again, having been involved with this initially and working with a different city attorney, of course, having been involved with this initially, I've followed up with this, and any opinion I've gotten since then would be questioning that aspect. So what I would guess is, whoever acquired this property for whatever amount, we'd be having our city attorney trying to defend that clause, and there probably would be some additional costs beyond the $4,080. So I think it's something to factor in, and certainly you could get more opinion on that, but I think we've heard from our city attorney. I know you would like to comment on that. I'm going to open it back up to you to address. And we're going to hear from him first, and we'll come on back to finish up with Heather, and then on to Councilman Kelly. You had a comment on this interchange.
I was going to share my opinion, since
Please.
There's been a lot of opinions. First of all, I very much respect the dialogue, and if the city's decision is, or the preference of the city, the policy of the city is, to consider acquiring the property and not wanting to develop, I fully respect that, and I have no problems with it whatsoever. When I first approached the city some months ago, the impression that I got was that city's preference was to see a commercial development on the site and not to be in the business of acquiring property and putting it up for requests for bid or proposal. And folks like myself would show up and say, I'm interested, I'd like to develop it. And I personally think that the property at the price that I'm buying which is substantially more, and bidding on it, because I know I can buy it for less than what I would be buying it today. At that point, all you have to do, really, is to get plans and permits for 45,000 square feet,
right,
and you're home free. I mean, those are the rules, and I think the city attorney will comment on that. So if the goal is to see a development here that's commercial, you have before you a seasoned developer. I've already proven that, you know, when we take on a project like Southside Villas, we go through with it, we get it done, we improve it. We have the financial wherewithal and the experience. And I'm very committed to work with the city. We have one other property that's in escrow that we plan on closing on, also in Atascadero, and we're looking to expand our footprint and do more projects in the city.
Well, let me bring it back to council, because now we're kind of getting off of this particular project. I'm sure we'll have some dialogue. Is there any closing comment pertinent to Ms. Moreno's question? Then we'll bring it back to council.
Yeah, the comment, the conclusion is that even if this goes to a tax sale, there are opportunities for anybody who bids on that to buy it at the roughly $330,000, $340,000 that's owed on it, and they will still have about a year to get plans and permits, and here we are. So, okay. Any questions I could answer?
Thank you. So we're going to finish up with Councilman Moreno's questions, then Councilman Kelly is next on the light.
Yeah, so no, I understand all of that, I think that's not what changes my mind, that's not to me, the critical piece is if our city attorney is saying that legally that could be a problem moving forward and trying to uphold that piece of it and then spend more money fighting it on the back end. That's certainly, I take that seriously. And I'm very anxious, I think, as anybody sitting here to get something going there. So whether it was Mr. Ephraim or somebody at a tax sale, anyway would be good. And if it can be Mr. Ephraim, then great.
Thank you. Councilman Kelly.
I just brought this up for discussion. Any sale at the courthouse steps is buyer beware to get clear title. I think you could get clear title for the taxes. You'll have to. There's always some type of mechanical liens in there, some that stay in place.
I'm sorry, that we add in that $4,080 that staff has put in time and expense and give that to Mr. Ephraim for payment.
I would suggest that we ask Mr. Ephraim whether he would be agreeable to that payment. So if he could resume the lectern.
Among the discussions we had initially was that we would pick up any cost that the city would incur in drafting and negotiating the paperwork. So,
okay, we'll like how you worded that. I think could the city attorney refine that slightly?
Well, yes. I guess the question would be, was that a yes?
I think that was a yes, but I didn't hear a dollar amount. I heard any costs associated with... Well,
it's Christmas time, Tom.
That's why I want to pounce on this quick. Could the city attorney word that in a way that
Can we just add any related costs?
No, I think that, let's be clear. My understanding from Mr. Frace is that the applicant has already paid the city staff costs to date. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Through the fees. So the only remaining cost then would be the reimbursement of the city for the legal fees and associated with the review of the documents and the negotiations with his attorney, et cetera. And the total on that is $4,080. So I guess
we might anticipate some slight amount more to conclude this, or is pretty much?
Yeah, I think it would not be a significant amount.
So it sounds like you can get off for $4,080 tonight only.
Nice. Going, gone.
Fine. I'll accept the add-on to my recommendation and my proposal.
If that's the motion, is that something agreeable to you? I think
it is agreeable. Yes.
Thank you. I'll bring it back to council. I have a motion on the floor by Councilwoman Fonsi, seconded by Councilman Kelly.
No, I think I made it.
Oh.
modified by motion by Councilman Kelly, seconded by Councilman Fonzie, and as modified. Any further discussion? Roll call.
Councilmember Kelly.
Yes.
Councilmember Fonzie.
Yes.
Councilmember Moreno.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Sturtevant.
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley.
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Very good. Thank you. Well, next on the agenda is management.
Wish me luck. I'm going to apply for the regular position on LAFCO. It'll go before the City Selection Committee. So I'm currently an alternate, and we'll see how it goes.
Yes, thank you. Councilmember Kelly.
Yes, I sit on the board of the Citizens Advisory Board down at the Atascadero State Hospital, and they're in the preliminary stages of incorporating a brand new safety program down there, where actually everybody in the hospital will be monitored on video screens, so they'll be able to keep track of where all the patients are, where all the employees are, and there's going to be some type of warning device. It's a multi-million dollar project that'll take a couple of years to go, so hopefully that'll cut back on some of the injuries and problems that they have down there.
Good. Well, I do want to thank all of you. This is probably the most active council I have been a part of in my now almost 12 years. Everyone is involved in committee work, and as you know, it's much more than just attending council meetings. These regional boards, and in case of Mr. Kelly on a state-appointed board, it's very important to our community that we participate, and it does our community a lot of good. I'm going to end with a few committee reports. The City Schools Committee has not met, but I did meet with staff, with the school district architect and with the their executive director, and it looks promising with their designs going ahead with the junior high. They did incorporate some of the concerns we had about keeping the East Mall road intact and kind of keeping what I'd call West Mall intact and the East Mall corridor open, which was we wanted to keep that historical aspect. They're also looking at using materials that would be compatible with our City Hall. In fact, Warren Frace gave some suggestions of where there's even some rejects that would be plenty good for the junior high. Not quite so many color variations. So anything we could do that they could go ahead and incorporate the concerns we've shared, I think they are working at that. I attended the county mayor's roundtable recently, and we did have an issue come up about some of the alternatives to electric power generation. I'm not going to go into details now, but that was something that's going to come back to council in a future session, so we'll review that a little bit more at that time. There was a discussion at a previous mayor's meeting that was surprising to me. We didn't share before because we quite a large area, and if you Google it, you would be shocked at how many you find in Atascadero, let alone in the county. These are areas that, again, council may want to look at some future date, because if any of these came online as TOT paying entities, could be expected, you'd have the equivalent of several more motels in town. So that's something you may want to look at down in the future. As you know, I took over as president of the Integrated Waste Management Authority, sometimes referred to as the plastic bag group. At our last meeting, towards the end, Debbie Arnold brought up a point that I agreed with as president. We were pretty quick to go through the plastic bag ordinance when it was considered, when Jim Patterson was the president. Of course, Frank Meacham and I wanted more time for education options, and there were some other options that we didn't really consider that Board Member Arnold has brought to our attention. For example, you now can get biodegradable plastic bags. It may be something that meets some of the needs, and it just wasn't considered before. So we agreed as a board. Frank Meacham supported us. Always good to find out more information, so we're going to be taking a look at that, Supervisor Arnold has done a lot of research in this area, and appreciate her work on that, and we'll see if anything comes of that. The Council of Governments, of course, has met, and there's a lot of stuff going on. We're always talking about money, and I wish we were talking about more money for our city. This year, we did not fare as well. It was one of the smaller dollar amounts for our city, though some very strategic projects I want to mention that's coming our way. But I also want to talk about how come we are kind of not doing as well, and I'll end on that point. But some of the things that we are going to be looking at is we did get some money to possibly look at that ramp closure across from the police department. I know that's something that the police department's very concerned about. Caltrans is very concerned because it really is backing up traffic on the freeway. So we did get some funding to study that, and what our staff has suggested, if we're to consider that, we need a lot of help in San Anselmo. There's a lot of problems there. We think that that's where traffic would shift, and we are, since this is something that's actually a high priority to Caltrans, we may get some extra help dealing with ways around Portola, so we could basically get across the street from our safe routes to schools over to the Veterans Memorial and the lake and the zoo. And so this would help take care of some of those issues with Caltrans. It potentially also could be that Caltrans looks at abandoning some of their right-of-way along 41. And what that would do for not only the city is we might be able to certainly get in a complete bike path, walking paths all along our scenic highway, connecting in out to the Lake Park Zoo. It also could significantly reduce the cost of development for all the property owners along 41, because it happens to be very expensive to develop for a five-lane highway as opposed to a three-lane highway. And so our staff are going to be looking into that along with Caltrans, that there might be some real possibility to accomplish some of our goals around the Lake Park Zoo and actually have a large part of that cost covered, and actually also reduce the costs for all the private property owners along that route. There's a few other minor things. We did get a lot of compliments from the audience who showed up to talk about the North County Salinas River Trail draft plan. You may have heard of that. We had a session here. And folks were very appreciative that we took strong action to exclude consideration of private property on a trail system, and yet still going forward with a trail system. So that is moving forward, and I think, again, our community was very appreciative of the work we did. Many showed up there to mention that. The concern I have is the way the funding is going statewide is that cities are expected more and more to put up, or shut up, no, actually to put up more match. And you might as well shut up if you don't have any match, because what's happening is we simply are not competitive with other cities. They are increasing the match ratio requirements. Every other city in our county has a sales tax portion pretty much dedicated to roads. They have dedicated funds going to roads that they can use for match. And the way the requirements are at not only SLOCOG, but also at most of the federal and state funding, they have a way of showing our U.S. self-help entity, that is, you're doing something specifically within your budget to support that. So wishing we could do more on roads. And so I bring that up because we had a request by the chamber to consider if we wanted to look at a sales tax initiative related to our roads in our community. And, of course, we can't take that action. I'm glad we can't just vote on that. Well, all we can do is support putting it on the ballot so our voters could consider. And we have thought about this for some time. I know it's actually budgeted in our current budget for the city manager has discretion to go ahead with a study to kind of see, similar to what SLOCOG and the other cities have done, to check in with our constituents, see what they think on this. So what I would like to do, again, it's not an action item, but by consensus, I would like to support staff in going ahead with that amount, and I think it would cost some amount to have some information that we could have it, hopefully by the time of our strategic planning session, so we could kind of see what impact that would have on our community. I know we have a backlog of something like 50 million or more of road work that we have no plan to ever be able to accomplish. And so I think we need to have some serious discussion, given that we now are going to be even less competitive for the few funds there are, what we're going to do about to close that gap. So I hope that's a big topic during our strategic planning, and I would ask for your consensus just to support staff in going ahead with a study so that we could have that information to review during strategic planning. So on that, I'll end on that note. I know if Russ, I know you've seen the same issues on some of the SLOCOG committee. Would you comment on your interpretation or impression of what you've seen?
No, I think you said it really well. I know that this latest round of funding was for regionally significant projects, and we just don't, you know, measure up to the 46 East extension or some of the major regionally significant projects. So it was a tough year. But I wholeheartedly agree with you on that it's going to be more and more competitive to get funding, and if you can't increase the match on projects, it's going to work against us. We're already seeing it now, and I've heard it time and time again that, you know, we are the only city without a sales tax measure, and it does handicap us.
Thank you. Any comment from our city manager, and see if we have some consensus?
Well, but it's not that long of a process, and I've talked to several consultants who think that it can be done between 4 to 6 weeks and at least have some preliminary discussion points for strategic planning.
A question for the city attorney. I feel like this should have been on the agenda. Just feels a little off to me to be discussing this like this right now.
Well, I think that the level of discussion so far has been acceptable. In terms of taking any action on this, I was speaking with the city manager, and she had indicated that this is something that's within her authority. So I believe that, and she's also indicated it's already been budgeted. Is that right? All right. So it's already something that's in the works. So you are not taking any action on this tonight, and I do think that you make a good point that this probably should be the conclusion to this discussion, since you've heard from the city manager already on it.
Very good. So unless someone has another comment to give to the city manager, we'll have more discussion. But any input on any of my reports or any of the other reports we've had? Go ahead.
And just a question regarding these biodegradable plastic bags. Does this mean that if they vote on it, that the bags would come back into the grocery stores and so forth?
Well, what Supervisor Arnold has researched, there are a number of states that their bag ordinance includes this. One, they don't have fines for lack of compliance, and two, they have some environmentally friendly alternatives. And my primary disappointment in the past is we really didn't have any discussion on alternatives. And so as president, I want to just make sure we at least consider all options. And as I say, Supervisor Arnold has found, like in Hawaii, they simply use biodegradable plastic bags in the stores, and then it is somewhat reusable, but they're also basically if they are, for example, I'm interested in this because as many know, I've been an advocate for food waste recycling. Well, how many folks are going to take a handful of garbage out somewhere? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking if one option that's actually been looked at in other areas is, let's say you have biodegradable bags, you might come home with some in the store, you might use it for something like that, and you could literally put it in a landfill and it will biodegrade instead of having a LAFCO board. All the mayors have commented of Roberta has been a real loyal alternate and is often participates better, I think, than some of our sitting members. And I think that is certainly on folks' minds. So I'm confident that your application will be well received. I certainly hope you'd be an excellent person for the job, so I'm really hoping that happens. So we'll see. Any staff input or parting comments by council before
I have one.
Yes.
Since this is our last meeting of the year, I would, on behalf of myself and I think the city council, I don't know if I can do this politically correct, but I would like to wish everybody a Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and a happy and prosperous 2014, not only to the staff and the city council, but to our citizens of Atascadero, who I think support us greatly. And I look forward to a great new year, and it's been a pleasure working with everybody this year.
I don't think anyone could say it better than Councilman Kelly has. I say we are adjourned.
Are you going?